You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Tressie McMillan Cottom, whose important new book I've just read is called Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Tressie McMillan Cottom, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
For having me, David.
It's a very interesting book. I wouldn't say cheerful.
Okay. About, I can live with that.
About for-profit colleges, which you describe as sort of resulting from the incredible inequality in our society and furthering it. Can you explain that?
Sure. So when I first started kind of doing this work, one of the things that really troubled me was how we really talked about for-profit colleges in this really narrow way. So they were either, like, you know, at the vanguard of higher education and doing every innovative thing, or they were just predators, you know, preying on millions of people and sucking the federal student aid system dry of billions of dollars. I come somewhere in the middle where I say those things can be partially true, but we actually sort of have a bigger problem. And for me, that problem is by reading the for-profit colleges, especially the large publicly traded shareholder for-profit colleges. So those are the ones that have the names that are probably really familiar to lots of people, like Strayer, the University of Phoenix, et cetera. By reading their financial documents, this is what we get. We get a story from these schools themselves. And the story they tell people is, we are a good investment because there are more people graduating from high school than are prepared for college, but those people need college for good jobs, so isn't this great? Well, that's great unless, like, you are like me and you sort of think that maybe producing millions of people from unequal K-12 schools is not a great business opportunity, that instead it's a social problem.
Right.
And I say it's a social problem precisely because the business model only works if we keep doing this vastly unequal thing. So that's the first part, like, right, why I say it stems from inequality. The second part of that is perpetuates inequality. Now, that all of that would be fine if for-profit colleges were transforming the opportunity for millions of people who don't have that opportunity anywhere else. And after about 15 years of really rapid growth, the data are in on whether or not that's true, and the data says they are not. That's not true. For-profit college students are more likely to be unemployed and for longer, and when they are employed, to earn less than students who go to traditional not-for-profit colleges.
Yeah.
And while there may be lots of reasons for that, it's still the reality.
Now, before you went into all of this research, you worked in admissions for for-profit colleges, and it sounds like with perhaps some regret.
So dealing with sort of like the regret issue was one of those that I kind of had to get over fairly quickly to sort of do this work, but absolutely with a sort of deep amount of compassion, I hope, and empathy is sort of what I developed from my time from working in for-profit colleges. So, yes, before I went to graduate school and got a PhD and became an academic and a sociologist and a researcher, I worked in two for-profit colleges in North Carolina. In the book, I refer to one as the beauty school and the other as the technical school. And my experiences there really are invaluable. It was precisely because I had worked with so many students, this really interesting cross-section of people, that I was able to see the research about for-profit colleges, I think, differently than my colleagues did and other researchers did. I knew that these students were not just prey, but I also knew that their choices weren't necessarily innovative and good either. I knew it was much more complex than that, and that's the complexity I went searching for.
Yeah, but so you don't exactly think it's all a scam, that the degrees are totally useless and the education is totally useless, but it is coming at a at a very high price, right? I mean, this is something of the expensiveness of being poor. You're paying even more money than you might for a better education somewhere else. It's just easier to get into, right?
Right. And that's actually the story, I think, if anything, this is the story about poverty and inequality in this country. We know that poverty is very expensive. It's expensive to be poor. We've looked at that in things like banking, for example, right, where poor people pay a lot for things like check cashing because they can't get access to a traditional bank. We've looked at it in housing, cars, I'm simply saying we also have the same phenomenon in higher education, and that's historically unique. So what used to be the case before, like, the mid-1990s was that the most prestigious colleges were the most expensive. And so, yeah, we sort of justified the high cost of those by saying, yes, but look, it's Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, right? So you're getting that. By the late 1990s, the most expensive colleges are the least prestigious. For-profit colleges become the most expensive, and poor people, therefore, are paying the most for college.
And they're getting into it not just because they qualify and are able to get into it, but because the credit is readily available. And as you recount in the book, some people are even using education, whether they have any interest in it or not, as a system for getting loans.
Yes. The connections to me to poverty were very stunning. I mean, even going in like I did, you know, wanting to understand how inequality was working, even for me, it was kind of stunning. So I've got students, for example, who say things like, listen, how else am I going to get, you know, a lump sum of money that isn't tied to my credit worthiness? And by lump sum, this is what is just so sad for me. That student, the one I have in mind in particular, Mike, he was talking about $5,000 or $6,000, right? He wasn't talking about 30 or 40 grand. But being able to get like $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 to extract that from his student loan borrowing was something that was going to help him, in his mind, do these other things that would improve his economic position, start a business, was his example.
Now, I think George W. Bush said that such people should shape up and just, you know, borrow a larger amount from their daddy.
And I can't believe the real story here is how many people chose not to be born to wealthy parents. Yeah. I think that is the real story.
It's shameful. But there is a lot of blaming the victims, right? Why did you go to that school? Why did you go so deeply into debt to go to such a lousy school? You know.
That's right. And I think the debt, I think the blaming, which is, again, one of the things that really motivated me to do this project and to do this work, I think the individual blame for the social problem bothered me probably most of all because it lets too many people off the hook. If we can say you should have known better, then we don't have to deal with the reality. And I argue the reality is that increasingly all of us are going to have to figure out how we can do this thing called lifelong learning and, you know, upping our skills for the new economy. Politicians love to promote this idea, right? The jobs of the 21st century will require us to do everything from code to do big data analytics. But nobody tells us how we're supposed to do that when employers no longer provide that kind of on-the-job training. All of us, sooner or later, if the new economy keeps going the way that it goes, we'll have to make the very decisions that today we blame for-profit college students for making.
Yeah. The description of how you, when you had that kind of job, and many others, when you went as part of your research and applied as an applicant to enroll in many of these schools, the work of the recruiters does not really resemble work for the social good, looking for who needs an education, what kind of education. It resembled, in my experience more closely than anything else, military recruitment.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
I mean, targeting the most likely to sign on the dotted line and then you're unable to back out. You know, don't ask them when their parents are around. Don't tell them how much it costs until they've already come and gotten engaged. You know, it is it like, I mean, in military recruitment, once they've signed, that's it. They can't get back. They can't back out.
Oh, well, that's actually, I wish we had talked before I wrote, David. That's a great analogy, actually. For my mind, what I was writing and what it reminded me of was timeshare sales. But no, I think this might be even better. And because the structure is very similar, if we even think about where military offices are located often, so these office parks, shopping malls, you know, strip malls, many for-profit colleges are in the same sort of locations.
Right. Well, you did talk about it as competition, and if the military shrinks its personnel, that's good for the for-profit colleges. Here, Donald Trump has proposed to radically increase its personnel, as did his predecessor, and that may be bad for the for-profit colleges, right?
Actually, yes. I mean, it's a bit perverse, but for us to think of it this way, but I remind people the military is an employer. It's actually one of the largest employers in the country and one of the largest employers that does not require college for entry, right? And so lots of poor people have always historically relied actually on the military to develop a professional career and to get professional training and good benefits. So perversely, if Donald Trump were to expand the military, yes, it could be competition for for-profit college students. In fact, for-profit colleges, the shareholder one said frequently that their only competitors were not other schools, that their competitors were the military and the economy, that if people had jobs or could get enlisted, that their prospective student pool would shrink dramatically. I think the only thing that probably complicates that and what maybe our dear president doesn't understand is that today the modern military will mostly expand by buying probably more drones than they will by hiring more people. So it might be more complicated than he assumes. But, yes, you're right. What he's proposing could ultimately really be more competition for for-profit.
Yeah. We're speaking with Tressie McMillan Cottom, and the book is Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. I think there's also another area of competition between this business and the military, and that is there are countries on this planet where you have free education from preschool through college treated as a human right, which we could have in the United States for a small fraction of military spending.
Absolutely.
So where has that idea gone? Is this part of the rise of these for-profit colleges?
It absolutely is. The rise of for-profit colleges could not have happened without an ideological shift happening first. And that shift, starting by the 70s, certainly picking up speed by the 80s, was the idea that education is just an individual good, right? The reason why individuals should pay so much for education, so more loans, fewer grants, is because they're the only ones who benefit, right? Well, that was a big change from our idea that education would benefit society at large, and so the public should sort of invest in it.
Yeah.
Without that ideological shift, we don't get, I think, the conditions that produce for-profit colleges. But yes, the idea is it is entirely possible for us to choose a different system of higher education, and I hope that's the takeaway from this book, that for-profit colleges, even if we were to get rid of them today, but if we kept all of the same ideological problems, economic problems, we're just going to produce a new kind of for-profit college. And that instead we can remove the predator motivation by shifting back to the understanding of education as a public good.
There are probably other factors that interplay with the ideological change, including, you know, a loss of better paying jobs and unionized jobs that didn't require a college degree, right?
Right. I actually think the decline of unionization might have been one of the most sort of on-the-ground conditions that led to the to adding value to the idea of for-profit colleges. Because what they were saying was employers are not willing to pay for this expense anymore.
Yeah.
And isn't that convenient? As it happens, we also have a federal student aid system that will pay for it. When you put those two things together, you've got the perfect scenario for the increase of for-profit colleges. So unionization was a way for workers to extract from their employers investment in their development and training. Now, we've thought about that as how often that manifests in things like better pay, better health insurance, and better retirement benefits like pensions. But I'm arguing that also one of the things that went the way of pensions and good health care and good pay was also employer-sponsored, employer-paid-for training.
Yeah, but only for the members of your union, not for the society at large.
That is
so
true.
Then there's
that
resentment and division. You know, it's not like Scandinavia where that's just free for everybody.
Exactly.
And so nobody resents the other people who get it.
That's right.
I was also struck in, you know, reading some of the content of the of what's taught at some of these for-profit colleges, and no doubt some nonprofit community colleges as well. Seems like stuff that you ought to know by high school or be able to teach yourself. I mean, to take a college course in how to use Quicken, which seems to me like a computer program that comes with instructions. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm underestimating the complexity of Quicken. I'm not, no expert, but it seems to me if you don't know how to, you know, open a computer program and read the instructions and teach it to yourself by high school, the problem is high school and elementary school.
Yeah, I think even high school, yes, might be a bit too late. I think, you know, there's a plethora of really great research out there about how inequalities play out in K through 12 education. And I do think that one of the things that we see in the for-profit college student universe is the logical outcome of now about 40 years of dialing back everything that was put in place to try to make public K through 12 school more equitable and more fair, and we're just dealing with that now. We're kind of at the end of that rope.
Yeah.
And it is important, I think, for us to keep in mind, I say this to my students, for example, all the time, and to other people that travel around and talk about this book, a lot of the things that we take for granted about what we know about how to learn or how to go to college, the quote-unquote right way, is something we really inherit from our parents. And if we didn't get that from our parents, we got it from school usually, K through 12. Well, there are millions of people whose parents don't know and whose K through 12 experiences don't teach them.
Yeah.
And they are graduating from high school with the same understanding of how to have a good life that all of us graduate with, which is go to school to have a good life. Our inheritance of the idea of how to do college the right way is not equitably distributed.
Very true. Very true. Do the for-profit, I mean, looking at this distinction between for-profit colleges and traditional or real colleges, do the for-profit colleges make any sort of pretense about training active citizens, or is it all about career? And is that one of the big differences?
Yes. Oh, that's a great question, David. Yeah, so because that's actually one of those ones that I was, like, really just personally interested in. So at one point, I took all of the marketing materials that I collected from all of these for-profit schools because I wanted an understanding of the messages like you were describing. But, you know, how do they explain themselves, right? How do they explain themselves to regulators, to taxpayers, but also to their students and prospective students and to employers?
Yeah.
And, yeah, there is very little. I mean, there are only a couple of cases that I can remember now off the top of my head of a for-profit school using any language that, you know, you and I would find familiar. Things like how to be a critical thinker or how to be a citizen and participate in democracy or, you know, those types of things.
Right.
I attribute that to the idea that increasingly we only understand being a good citizen by being a good consumer. That, our language about citizenship has become so impoverished that it is actually acceptable now for an institution to say it is providing a public good because it provides workers and people who can consume. Because all they talked about was, sort of developing a good worker. And I think that's a real loss for us as a public.
Well, they'll lose the planet if that's what people think of as, you know, being a good citizen.
I agree.
We shouldn't idealize the traditional colleges, which are full of problems and full of cheating, you know, but I found it interesting that in your book that there seemed to be an inclination, at least by some people, to sign up for an online college course that's going to have the same material it always has, but different professors, so nobody knows anybody, and get all the answers from somebody who took it before, and go ahead and cheat. And no real motivation not to cheat when the whole point is to get a degree, not to learn something.
That's right. The incentives are absolutely rational, right? That was one of my takeaways from that, too. And there is a really now robust, you're right, and it's not just for-profit colleges. There's a technology has made it possible for there to be a really robust underground economy of materials and support to help students cheat. Now, we're all sort of dealing with that, but it is extremely more easy in the for-profit college sector because of some of the structural differences. So what students told me is the things that would normally trip up a student who wanted to do that are things like your professor would catch on, right? So
yeah.
In the traditional class, your professor who always teaches this class would know, oh, this looks like a paper I got last semester.
Yeah.
Well, if you're attending a for-profit college that doesn't have unionized faculty or faculty governance, and I know it can be like a dirty word, I think, to some people, but one of the things that faculty governance does is it provides stability among faculty. Well, for-profit colleges don't have faculty governance, and because of that, they tend to treat faculty much like employees in other parts of the economy do. They're easily replaceable, and so they tend to have a high turnover rate. So there is a higher chance, if you went to the for-profit college, that this course you took this semester will be taught by a different person than who taught it last semester.
Yeah.
But the materials will be the same, because at the for-profit colleges, the faculty don't own the materials, the school owns them. So they'll use the same test, the same assessments, the same reading, but a different person will be teaching it. So like our first line of defense against cheating, the faculty member has been significantly weakened in the for-profit college sector.
Yeah. I wonder to what extent, I don't know if your book, your research covered this, but to what extent these for-profit schools and their culture are influencing the traditional universities.
Mm-hmm. I
know.
Absolutely, a lot. Yeah, you're right. It's not as central to this book. You know, I think I got it embedded in some footnotes. But there is this idea, sociologists, Sheila Slaughter and Gary Rhodes have this term they call academic capitalism.
Yeah.
And that is their idea and their theory. And what they say is that certainly by the 1970s and certainly today, that the lines between not-for-profit and for-profit colleges are becoming more and more blurry.
Yeah.
And that it might be better for us, instead of thinking of them actually as two different things, to think of them as being on a spectrum, right? You're moving from one to the other, that we've adopted a lot of the practices of for-profit colleges. And in fact, I think a lot of the talk about things like, you know, MOOCs, we had a moment for MOOCs. Now we talk about things like boot camps or badges or micro-credentials. All of these things adopt a lot from for-profit colleges. Especially the idea that you really kind of need to get rid of faculty, and certainly faculty governance and control, that you need to give students optimal amounts of choice because they are consumers, right? And you need to get rid of all of that stuff that's like about critical thinking and whatnot, because consumers aren't into that, right? They just need the skill. And not-for-profit colleges have been responding to that for lots of reasons, lots of pressures. And so, no, we've adopted many of the things that have been common in for-profit colleges for at least 40 years.
I wonder if a way to turn the market ideology nonsense around on people would be to give students the liberty to actually choose the education they want by giving everybody a basic income guarantee and not making it a struggle for survival. Then what education would students pick?
That's my solution. Thank you, David. I agree with you 100%. I say attack the demand, right? Instead of trying to fix this problem at the level of regulation, if we know that the real issue is that people are making choices out of desperation, then let's look at why people are so desperate. Well, as it turns out, for-profit colleges will tell you themselves. Most people come to see us when they have just been laid off, or are afraid that they're about to be laid off. Oh, well, then that's about economic insecurity.
Yeah.
Well, we know how to do that, right? We know how to put a floor beneath that process, and that would be a basic job guarantee. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, then you couldn't put 65% of federal discretionary
exactly.
spending into the military. You'd have to you'd have to put a little
exactly
bit into something.
Right.
Speaking of which, there's one famous for-profit school that I don't think came up in the book much, which is Trump University.
Yep.
Speaking of cheaters, what, mm-hmm. where does that fit in the spectrum of for-profit schools?
Yeah. So Trump University is this interesting blip, I guess, which is it's the most egregious of sort of the things that we think about as being related to for-profit colleges, because Trump didn't even actually set up a school. What he essentially had was like this real estate correspondence program. So he didn't even go about the performance or the theater of being an actual school. For example, you know, there were no actual classes or faculty, et cetera. But it was so cynical that he knew to trade on the name university, right? He knows how much that means to the general public, that for lots of reasons we still put a lot of faith in the idea of university. Mm-hmm. So it was just a very cynical marketing plan. But it did embrace some other elements of for-profit colleges, which was focusing on people who, again, were economically insecure. I watched the testimonials during the election of people who had attended Trump University.
Uh-huh.
And I was struck by their stories, and one in particular at the DNC convention. It was a woman who had just lost her husband and, as a result, had an insurance payment, right, that had provided her this, you know, unexpected lump sum of money, but under the worst possible condition. And that's why she had the money to pay for Trump University. And she was afraid, having lost her husband, that her income potential was going to be cut significantly, which is true for lots of women. And I just was struck by how much her story of economic fear and insecurity was so much like the students that I interviewed in this book.
Yeah.
And that's what I think it ultimately had in common, that part of people that they are preying on.
We've just got 2 minutes left. What do you recommend, short of building a better society, what do you recommend to students who are desperate for some sort of credential that will get them a better job or for actually some sort of useful education? What's your advice?
Oh man. I always counsel students to ask really good questions, and the one that I have found to be sort of the best question to get at the heart of whether or not you're at a for-profit or a not-for-profit, or if so, whether you should be concerned, is that when you're talking to people about school, we have told you to ask things like, how much does it cost and what's the admissions process? Instead, ask them whether or not your credit hours would transfer to another university. That tells you something really important. It tells you how other people view your school.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing that prospective for-profit students don't know enough about. How do other people view that institution? So that's one thing I try to counsel people. But the other that I counsel people who are especially right now, I think, waking up to the idea of sort of organizing and local organizing especially, is that some of this we can address at local and state level. You know, for-profit colleges to operate in your state have to have state permission, even if they are, you know, headquartered somewhere else. So there's state oversight of for-profit colleges, and that's a site for organizers to start engaging and thinking about, how does your state allow a school to operate in your state? Maybe you should find out, and find out if they have things like avenues for citizens to respond, and if they don't, you could probably ask why they don't. And so I think this opportunity, yeah, both at the local organizing level and among individuals.
Very good advice, and there's more of it in the book. I highly recommend it. It's called Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. The author is Tressie McMillan Cottom. Tressie, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Talk Nation.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnake.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the House Republicans have unveiled their long-promised replacement to what they presented for many months as the unmitigated disaster of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Washington Post says, the most serious threat to the passage of this GOP bill is that conservative Republicans don't like it. How well does that framing set us up to talk about other people's concerns, like what these Trump-backed changes could mean for the millions of people with disabilities and senior citizens who rely on Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security programs that are relatively starved for media attention as it is? We'll talk about press coverage of Trump Care with Nancy Altman. She's co-director of the group Social Security Works and author of the book The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. Also on the show, the Supreme Court recently announced that it won't hear the case of Gavin Grimm, the transgender boy seeking the right to use the boys' bathroom in his high school, and it will kick it back to a lower court. That might sound like a non-event, but the Supreme Court's refusal to offer a full-throated defense of transgender rights right now serves as yet another signal that transgender people, already extremely vulnerable, can count on still less protection from state institutions. And that signal is having an impact. We'll talk about the court decision and about resistance to the message it sends with Chris Hayashi, Executive Director of the Transgender Law Center. All of that is coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. A welcome return. That's the Guardian newspaper's sincere description of George W. Bush's mild criticisms of Donald Trump on NBC's Today Show. As Owen Higgins noted on Fair.org, Bush extolled the virtues of the news media, indispensable to democracy, he says, waxed philosophical on the contributions of immigrants, and decried Trump's Muslim ban as antithetical to America's tolerance of other faiths, which Bush called a bedrock of our freedom. Well, Bush took that show on tour. He appeared on The Ellen Show and posed for pictures on the host's Instagram account. Then he swung by Jimmy Kimmel for a friendly discussion about his new book of paintings, paintings of 100 or so of the U.S. veterans that he sent to war. "I was thinking of their stories, their troubles, their joys," Bush shared with People magazine. The Guardian editorial said, quote, "It says a lot about the United States that Mr. Bush can be seen now as a paragon of virtue," close quote. But it really only says a lot about U.S. corporate media. As Higgins notes, news media have been massaging the images of Oval Office alumni for decades, with this post-presidential rehabilitation mainly used to try and push the current president to adopt some policy or priority. George W. Bush himself left office as the disgraced son of a dynasty, with his own father presented, relatively, as a respected elder statesman. The wreck he made of Iraq and the disasters left behind after his unilateral invasions of Panama and Somalia, forgiven and mostly forgotten. The same historical amnesia is at work now in elite media's group hug for George W. Bush, such that a person who called for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage can now laugh with Ellen DeGeneres and stump for a book of paintings of veterans he himself put in harm's way. The book is called Portraits of Courage, a Commander-in-Chief's Tribute to America's Warriors. As Vijay Prashad notes on Alternet, there are no paintings of Iraqis, civilians or soldiers. And, quote, not one of the profiles in Courage includes the Iraqis who collaborated with the U.S. occupation and now find themselves unable to enter the United States as a consequence of Trump's Muslim ban, close quote. Prashad cites a moment on the Today Show when Bush said to Matt Lauer, quote, we need an independent media to hold people like me to account, close quote. Well, watching the guy who launched an illegal war responsible for the deaths of at least a half million people, who codified torture into U.S. law, who abated the unnatural disaster of Hurricane Katrina and the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression, cheered like a favorite uncle, I'd have to say we couldn't say it better ourselves. And finally, March 8th marked an international women's strike, a coordinated day of action, not limited to work stoppage, that organizers said was intended to highlight how women's work, contributions, and humanity continue to be undervalued. With an avowed misogynist in the White House, the day got more media attention than it usually does. We saw stories about events around the world and interviews with participants. Some women-focused websites offered no new content as a show of support. We're told MTV's female staffers stayed out, and the network turned its logo upside down, making the M a W. And the Washington Times reports women anchors on MSNBC and CNN showed their leftist leanings by wearing red. Well, what we didn't see was media taking the day as a chance for serious self-reflection or conversation about how their portrayals of women and the absences contribute to that continued discrimination. The most recent data from the Women's Media Center tell us that men write 62% of the stories in the top 10 newspapers. Men write 58% of the content at four top online news sites, 62% of wire stories, and in the nightly broadcast news, men are on camera 68% of the time. In a piece for The Nation, strike organizers Tithi Bhattacharya and Cinzia Arruza stressed that the New York City rally would feature no celebrities, instead foregrounding the women you don't usually see in the media. Well, if media keep missing opportunities to look in the mirror, that won't be any less necessary next March 8th. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Far from seamless was how the Washington Post described the debut of House Republicans' much-vaunted, by them, replacement for the Affordable Care Act. Like others, this story was about how right-wing Republicans might present hurdles to the plan's passage because it's too much like the dreaded Obamacare and how they might be appeased. So much coverage of health care is set in terms of the political process, who presents obstacles, what groups are being whistled to, that the specifics, the reality of how changes in policy could affect actual people, can sometimes get lost. And health care could hardly be a worse place for that to happen. Here to help us see some of what's going on with this GOP bill is Nancy Altman. She's co-director of Social Security Works and co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition and Campaign. She joins us now by phone from Maryland. Welcome back to Counterspin, Nancy Altman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems that in the media, Medicare and Medicaid are mostly mentioned as a kind of in one breath tag on to Social Security, you know, when a story is giving a thumbnail of so-called entitlements. These programs are rarely center stage. I wonder if you could tell us about how this Republican plan, from what we know of it, would affect Medicare and Medicaid, and along the way, remind us of what those programs do.
The so-called Trump Care, this new health care plan that the Republicans have just rolled out, is very destructive to both Medicare and Medicaid. The Republicans ran against the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare, but no one ran against Medicare and Medicaid because the programs work very well and they're very popular. Medicare is both programs were enacted in 1965. The idea behind Medicare is that it's a part of Social Security that you cannot really be economically secure if you're one illness away from bankruptcy. So Medicare provides basic health insurance for those 65 and over who are receiving Social Security. Medicaid is intended as a low-income program, but it is the only part of our healthcare system that provides basic insurance for long-term care. So actually, many seniors, many middle-class seniors who find themselves in need of long-term nursing home care wind up relying on Medicaid. So they are both programs that cover much of the Social Security beneficiary population. All three programs work very well. They're very popular. And I should say one more thing, that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and other Republicans have been gunning for all these programs for decades.
Right.
And now I think they see they have their chance. So what this does is it basically destroys Medicaid. That was expanded under the Affordable Care Act. That expansion is going to be gone. But in addition, they're going to, instead of now having, if you've got that insurance and you need a medical procedure and it gets paid for, instead they're going to do a kind of cousin of block granting where they're going to give the states money and just say, okay, you take care of your own population. States often are strapped. It will be very hard to keep that coverage. And for Medicare, they literally raid Medicare. They take about several hundred billion dollars out of Medicare, and what they do is give very large tax breaks for the very wealthy.
Well, let me just add that Medicaid, of course, listeners should know, besides with seniors, of course, it's also a main source of funding for a wide variety of disability services as well. People with disabilities, including older people who need attendance, or even, you know, Ari Neiman wrote a piece on Talk Poverty talking about, you know, the 24-year-old with Down syndrome who gets a job coach, the 6-year-old with a disability whose parents need support. Medicaid is also critical to people with disabilities and providing them more independence and freedom. That's true.
That's exactly right. And to millions of children in this nation, too, who are low income.
Right, right.
So it is, and Medicare also provides basic insurance for people with disabilities. So it's seniors, which is why the AARP has come out against this bill. But as you point out, it's millions and millions of other Americans.
Right. Well, the Washington Post, that piece had a source from Heritage who was talking about how this GOP plan isn't good enough because it doesn't create a free market healthcare system. So, you know, that's one of the points on the continuum of conversation, is a system where poor people just die, you know, because I don't know what else that means. Now, some people maybe are ideologically okay with that, but for a lot of people, I think it fits with their understanding that we're just in a situation of scarcity. We can't afford a system that the government administers. That's, if you would say, the big lie.
That is the big lie. We are the wealthiest nation in the world, and we are at the wealthiest moment in our history. We're wealthier than we were in 1935 when Social Security was enacted. We're wealthier now than we were in 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid were enacted. And you are exactly right. The long-range plan for Medicare is to what they call voucherize it, which is basically to turn the clock back before 1965. Before 1965, millions of seniors could not get health insurance at any price because they had pre-existing conditions. They were just seen as too expensive. And those that could had to pay huge markup for health insurance. And that's why we wound up getting Medicare. They want to turn this back to the private sector and let people just go out and give them some premium support to go out and buy some premiums and to buy insurance and help a little pay for premiums, when that is just the wrong way to go.
Well, I guess we have to push back then with like a big truth or a bigger vision. And I have seen some people saying, well, the fact that this plan is creating these kind of fissures even among Republicans for whatever reasons, but, you know, that they think maybe that's opening space to talk about single payer.
Medicare for all. Medicare was intended as a first step. In fact, there was a debate whether you first covered all children because it's much less expensive and they have a lifetime of health, or seniors, where, as I said, the need was dire. But they saw it as simply the first step. Even though Medicare covers the most expensive part of our population, seniors and people with disabilities, it is much more efficient than private sector insurance because it is universal for all people over age 65. Other countries can provide all of their citizens with complete affordable access to health care, and they have better health outcomes, and they spend less than we do. If we expanded Medicare to for all and started by simply lowering the age to 62, putting in a MediKids program, we would have a much more efficient program, and maybe that's where we're going, because that is a system that works.
Right. And, you know, just in terms of how we talk about it, it seems, you know, maybe not easy, but straightforward. And then also, an estimated 1 in 5 Americans have some form of disability. Everybody's going to get old if they're lucky. And yet, these show up kind of as interests in the media conversation. You know, there's a New York Times piece, repeal of health law faces a new hurdle, older Americans. You know, there's this frame of some against others, like it's Lord of the Flies, you know, as though we can't think about healthcare from a kind of whole society viewpoint, which, of course, seems like the way to go.
It is. I mean, this is really Washington at its worst, where families are interest groups. You have children against grandparents. Right. That is not how America works. Our grandparents are not better off if their grandchildren are not well educated, and grandchildren are not better off if their grandparents can't afford the basic necessities of life. So we are all in this together. It's one of the strengths of all of these programs, Social Security and Medicare. The concept is we all contribute, and as you say, we all hope to get old if we have the misfortune of becoming disabled. We have these basic programs that are there for all of us. It unites us, and we are certainly wealthy enough not only to afford these current programs, but to expand them.
We've been speaking with Nancy Altman. She's co-director of the group Social Security Works and co-author of the book Social Security Works, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us. Nancy Altman, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Listeners may know the name Gavin Grimm, the transgender teen boy from Virginia, whose case for his right to use the boys' bathroom in his high school, the Supreme Court has just declined to hear. You are less likely to know the name Ciara McKelveen, a New Orleans outreach worker for the homeless, or Jamie Lee Wounded Arrow, a nursing student in South Dakota. Two of the at least 7 trans women killed violently just so far in 2017. The failure of institutions like the court to prioritize the human rights of transgender people and the daily violence committed against them might seem like 2 separate, if related, stories, but maybe it's really only 1 story about continued resistance to accepting transgender people, including kids, as fully human, deserving of inclusion and protection. We're joined now by Chris Hayashi, Executive Director of the Transgender Law Center. He joins us by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Counterspin, Chris Hayashi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when media headlines reported that the Trump White House's retraction of the Obama administration's guidance around the rights of transgender students in public schools, when the headline said that that meant those rights were rescinded or revoked, they were just wrong. And it seems important to make clear that that kind of move doesn't change the law, no matter what anybody says. But it's also the case that a decision like the one the Supreme Court just made on Gavin Grimm, that kind of thing can still have an effect, can't it? I wonder what's your response in particular to the court's decision.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to be clear that both the Trump administration's rescinding of the guidance a few weeks ago and the Supreme Court's decision not to hear Gavin Grimm's case and to send it back down to the Fourth Circuit, none of those change the fact that the law is firmly on the side of transgender students and that transgender students are protected from discrimination under the law in this country. However, it is very true that both the rescinding of the guidance coupled with the Supreme Court's decision not to hear Gavin's case really sends a very clear message to transgender students that this new administration does not value them and will not protect their rights. I think it also sends a really clear message to school districts around the country that this new administration will not hold them accountable to the law. And, you know, for transgender young people who already face violence and harassment on the streets and in their schools, you know, even though transgender students are protected under the law from discrimination, we hear stories all across the country from transgender students who continue to face discrimination and harassment in their schools simply for who they are. And the actions of the administration just send such a clear message to young people who are already facing harassment that this administration does not value them and will not protect their rights.
Well, the Transgender Law Center just filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of some groups that work with trans students and families. And I think there's a value to showing it as being about family, after all, and saying, you know, these aren't controversies. They're kids. And I think media could use that recentering, too.
Absolutely. And I would also say that it's absolutely important to hear the voices and stories of transgender students themselves and their families all across the country. And it's also true that there are transgender young people all across the country who are also incredible leaders and organizers and who are fighting for their rights in their schools and in their communities, speaking out at rallies and protests, making public statements that transgender young people themselves are also taking action and standing up for their rights.
Well, part of the reason, of course, that people are concerned about the Supreme Court's punt, if you will, is that by the time it comes back to the Supreme Court could be different. In just a few weeks, we're going to be looking at hearings around Trump's appointment, Neil Gorsuch. What would a Gorsuch appointment mean, or what could it mean for transgender people?
Yeah, I mean, we are really clear that a Gorsuch appointment, that he clearly does not support the rights of transgender people, and that that would be incredibly harmful for him to be on the Supreme Court. You know, I'll also say that a piece of this story that is important to know, too, is that in addition to Gavin's case, there are also a number of other cases of transgender young people across the country. For example, at the Transgender Law Center, we are representing a transgender boy who lives in Wisconsin, and similar to Gavin, you know, was discriminated, his school discriminated against him. He was singled out to use a restroom separate from other boys in the school. And his school actually took it a step further, and they required that all transgender students wear green wristbands so they could better monitor their bathroom use.
Oh my God.
We were successful in getting a preliminary injunction on behalf of the young person, and so the school is not able to enforce that policy. And that case is actually going to be heard in the Seventh Circuit on March 29th, so really at the end of this month.
That is shocking. And I guess it takes me to the question, the fact that I think many listeners will not have heard about that brings me to the question of media coverage. You know, I've been saying that I think there's some link between not just the difficulty in getting a court to assert clearly the full human rights of trans people, but also the difficulty in getting media to accept it as a human rights issue and not a controversy or a political football. You know, that there's a link between that and actual harm to trans people. But if that kind of coverage can push in one direction, what sort of coverage would move us in a more positive direction? I mean, I would start with just information about the cases like the one that you've cited.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I also think that it's important. You know, we're in this moment, right, where for the transgender movement, there is a level of visibility that we have that is so different than even like 3 or 4 years ago. You know, we have folks like Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, highly, highly visible people. And then the reality is that at the same time, the majority of transgender people, particularly transgender people of color in this country, are really struggling to survive on a daily basis and facing violence and harassment. You know, as you were speaking to earlier, there have been 7 murders of transgender women of color in this country, and we're only barely into March. 2016, we saw the most reported number of murders of transgender people that we ever have. And, you know, again, those are just the murders that we know about. And it's that type of violence against our community that is often not told by the media, along with the incredible organizing and leadership that both transgender young people and transgender adults all across the country are continuing to move forward in the face of incredible violence and discrimination to fight for the rights of our communities, to keep our communities safe, and to build a different vision for what this world can look like.
All right, then. I'd like to thank you. We've been speaking with Chris Hayashi of the Transgender Law Center. They're online at transgenderlawcenter.org. Chris Hayashi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the media watch group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. While you're there, you can take the chance to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra. We also have digital subscriptions. Or to sign up for our Action Alert Network. You could also show support for FAIR and for Counterspin, if you're so inclined. Support we greatly appreciate. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we've got black swans, boiling frogs, a German philosopher, and a human drive toward collapse. It's another week in these times of Eco Shock. Rupert Reed from the University of East Anglia is our first guest, followed by American systems scientist Safa Modashari. But first, with climate change in mind, this message from Leo Tolstoy.
At the advent of danger, there are always two voices that speak with equal force in the human heart. One, very reasonably, invites a man to consider the nature of the peril and the means of escaping it. The other, with a still greater show of reason, argues that it is too depressing and painful to think of the danger, since it is not in man's power to foresee everything and avert the general march of events. And it's better, therefore, to shut one's eyes to the disagreeable until it actually comes, and to think instead of what is pleasant. When a man is alone, he generally listens to the first voice, in the company of his fellow men, to the second. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace.
The arrival of climate change has been described as a black swan event. It is something we humans have never experienced, and awful impacts are possible. Now, as the weather goes weird and the poles melt, why can't we act against the obvious threat? Rupert Reed is a British academic and Green Party politician. He has worked with the well-known black swan author Nassim Taleb. In the February 23rd issue of The Ecologist magazine, Rupert argues climate change is a white swan. Rupert is the chair of the Greenhouse think tank. He has been the UK Green Party spokesperson on transport and a respected reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. I think it's time to meet Rupert Reed. Rupert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, good to be here.
We have lots to talk about, but why not start with a question any sane person has to ask? We see climate change looming like a dark cloud over the future, so why are we frozen or running in the opposite direction as they are in the United States and Australia at the government level anyway? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is really what I'm trying to get at in my thinking about climate change as a white swan. What I mean by that is that now we can see climate change coming straightforwardly towards us. It's no longer a surprise distantly on the horizon. We look at the events in the polar regions right now. We look at the continually rising global temperatures. We see the scientific models getting surer and surer. We've got 99%, not 97% of climate scientists now on board with the accepted wisdom that dangerous climate change is happening and that it's man-made. It's no longer unexpected. It's as common or as expected as seeing a white swan on the river. It's not a surprise anymore. So why can't we see this and respond to it? Why can't we act on it? There's a number of reasons. I think one of the most simple ones is that there are some people with a strong vested interest in continuing for as long as possible to deny what's happening, and they include, of course, fossil fuel magnates, the fossil fuel companies, and so on. But it goes deeper than that. I think that something really strange and worrying is going on, where it's now so obvious that this threat is hanging over us, so obvious that it's dire, and yet there are so many people still in denial. And I argue also that in some ways, most of us are actually at a certain level in denial. We can't really face the extraordinary reality of what is tragically starting to happen. I think it raises big issues for our psychology. I think it raises big philosophical issues, as well as political and economic issues, obviously. So I think we need to do a lot more thinking about this, as well as getting on with it and starting to act on it, because this is dire. It's going to get worse, and our children will never forgive us if we don't get it sorted.
Meanwhile, many of us have been expecting, I think, some sort of paranormal event, a climate impact so gigantic and terrible that all the nations will unite in a rapid response. But what if climate change just crawls in instead, making our lives a bit more difficult and more miserable over the years? What if that's how it arrives?
Yeah, well, that is part of the problem. Part of the reason why it's so hard to grapple with and act on is it doesn't strike people as an emergency. So comparisons are made, for example, with the Second World War, and in many ways the comparisons are apt. So there was a Holocaust in the Second World War. The devastation that climate change could wreak could be, in the long run, far, far greater than that in terms of the number of people killed. The threat in the Second World War demanded serious action, and yet people were at first slow to act. Winston Churchill was accused of being an alarmist for raising the alarm about what was happening in Nazi Germany, and that's exactly what he said. He said, look, I'm not an alarmist, I'm raising the alarm. There's an important difference. But of course, it was much easier to respond to because it was a threat that was kind of in people's faces, at least by about 1938, 1939. It had a clear enemy. There was a clear trajectory as to what you needed to do to deal with it. These are features which are not present in the case of climate change, which is why I call climate change a diffuse object. It's an object which is very, very difficult to see. It is long-lasting. It is all around us in a certain sense. It is influenced by virtually everything that we do. But, you know, when you started saying, Alex, that what if it's so slow and then we don't react to it, the analogy which is often used is that of frogs, the idea that frogs, if you put them in water and slowly boil the water, that they will get boiled. And what I say in response to that is it turns out that that isn't actually true, that your average frog will jump out of the water at a certain point, even if you turn up the heat very slowly. So one way I like to put this is, can't we be at least as smart as frogs? Right? Can't we be as wise as frogs? One would have thought we were wiser than that. And the great philosopher Aristotle said, the thing which is special about humanity is that we are the rational animal. Well, that question is now in the balance. Are we the rational animal or not? If we are at least as rational as frogs, then we will address this, even if it just keeps creeping up on us slowly. And so I think that's maybe a hopeful thought, because I think surely we are at least as rational as frogs.
You know, I've never had the courage or the stupidity to test that out, you know, throw a frog in a bucket and see what happens.
Well, it'd be a bit cruel, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. But we're being very cruel to our children and our grandchildren by carrying on in this warming bucket without taking any action. And I know that you presented a shock message for young students. What did you tell them?
Well, yeah, what I told them was that we are in unprecedented times, that it's no longer possible for us to assume that life as normal and business as usual will go on. I told them that although this was an address to freshmen arriving at university, although it was a wonderful thing to be arriving at university, I frankly, in a very important respect, didn't envy them, because young people, I'm 50 years old, young people are going to face a lot more of this than I am. I mean, I'm very worried about my old age, frankly. I'm worried about what kind of world we're going to be living in. But if you're 15 or 20, it's absolutely a terrifying prospect if you can dare to look it in the face. Well, what does this mean? Well, it means that we have to act. We have to respond. We have to look at this. We have to do it urgently. We also have to do it in a deliberate way over a period of years. This is not going to get solved overnight. If we're going to solve it at all, it's going to take a long time. So then I started to talk with the students about the kinds of things we need to be doing differently. One of the key things, it seems to me, that needs to be brought in now urgently and strongly is the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle basically says that if you're not sure how bad something is going to be, but you know that it could be really bad, then you need to act preemptively to stop it. And that does apply to climate change. I mean, we are sure that climate change is here, basically, unless you're some kind of extremist like Donald Trump. We are sure that climate change is here. We are sure it's man-made. We are sure that it will be bad unless we stop it. But we aren't sure just how bad it's going to be. And some people use that as a prevaricating technique. They say, well, you know, maybe it's not going to be as bad as they say. But of course, the truth is that if you're uncertain how bad something is going to be, that it doesn't just go one way. Climate change could be a lot worse than we think. It could be a lot quicker. It could be a lot more devastating. There are feedbacks that could come in. For example, if we get the Amazon rainforest dying off relatively quickly, or if ocean currents stop working properly, or if there is a sudden jump in methane levels being released in the polar regions or in the seas, dangerous climate change could be a lot worse than the scientists are telling us. The only rational thing to do, the only precautious thing to do, and this is what the precautionary principle says, is to act now strongly to stop the worst-case scenario from being able to happen. And, of course, we know the kinds of things that that means. It means changing our farming methods radically. It means stopping deforesting the Earth. It means, most obviously of all, stopping burning fossil fuels so much, and we have to leave the clear majority of them in the ground. This is going to be very difficult to accomplish because we're dealing with huge vested interests and long ingrained habits. But we can do it. We could do it. And so the responsibility is absolutely on us to do it. And this is why, although in a certain sense it's a terrible time to be alive and a terrible time to be young, in another sense it's an awesome and a hugely exciting time, because what an incredible responsibility, what a chance to be the people who have the chance of actually saving the future and changing the destiny of humankind and putting us onto a much safer track. That is a positive way of looking at the awesome responsibility which now hangs over all of us.
Yes, there's both hope and fear for us there in the younger generation. I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, I've collected pages of headlines warning that robots are coming to take our jobs, all sorts of jobs. And at the Greenhouse Think Tank, I noticed that Andy Permain published an e-article titled Newer Times, What the Age of Robots Means for Labor and Green Politics. But it seems to me in response, you seem to call robotization almost a distraction. Why?
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about robotization now, including, as you say, from my colleague Andy Permain in the Greenhouse Think Tank. I think that something which has been neglected in all this talk is that the kind of robot utopia or dystopia, whatever it is, that people are talking about and are imagining and saying and are saying is starting to happen already, if that comes in, it's going to demand an enormous increase in use of energy, an enormous increase in use of materials. Now, people say, no, it won't, because robots can be brought in fairly efficiently and so on. But the question here is this. If you're going to have robots additionally to all the people that there already are, then it's bound to increase the pressure on the Earth. It's bound to increase energy use. It's bound to increase materials use. I'm very worried about the amount of waste that's going to be generated by broken robots and finished robots and so on and so forth. So why does this mean that I don't actually in the end think that the worry about robotization taking away all our jobs or indeed robots conquering the planet and ruling over us all, why am I not so scared about this as many people are? Well, because I'm more scared of something else, which is that I think that the likely scenario, if we do go down a heavy robot-intensive route of further industrialization in the next 10 or 15 years, is that we will simply hasten ecological collapse. Because the Earth cannot tolerate any more burdens on it in terms of resource extraction, pollution, energy overuse. We're straining up against, we're breaching the limits to growth. Dangerous climate change is simply the most obvious symptom of this and the most direly, directly harmful to us. So what I think will happen if we do go down the robotization path, as currently seems to be likely, unless we manage again to change society's direction quite radically, what I think is likely to happen is it will simply accelerate ecological collapse. It will simply accelerate the time when we start to go into a vicious circle of worsening conditions and societies falling apart, most likely, although not necessarily, through climatic disaster, through a series of climatic disasters, indeed, which people call climate chaos, as well as just the general ratcheting up of the temperature worsening the climatic situation for us across the planet. Robotization, if it's not stopped, I think is less likely to lead to a kind of robot apocalypse or even to robots taking away all our jobs, and more likely to lead to an intensified and more rapid period of climate disaster. And now here's the thing. If the robot lovers, if the people who say, oh, robots are going to be great, you know, they'll give us all a leisurely future, etc., if those people are actually serious, if they're saying that robots can actually reduce our ecological footprint, remember we're living right now in countries like the UK and the US as if we have four or five planets. When I last looked, we only had one. if those people are right in thinking that robots could actually reduce our ecological footprint, then they have a very interesting and actually very unpleasant thing to explain, which is how is that going to be possible without a massive forced reduction in human population? Because that's the only way I can see the figures adding up. You see what I'm saying? If the robots, as they inevitably are going to do, are going to have a significant ecological footprint, a significant impact upon us ecologically, the only way the figures add up is if there are a hell of a lot less humans quite quickly. So what I would like to ask the advocates of a robot future is, which humans precisely do you want to replace? Which people or which peoples are going to be told that they cannot reproduce or indeed forcibly contained in their numbers? What's it going to be, a mass sterilization program or something? The only way that the figures add up, the only way it's going to be possible for there to be a robot-heavy future which doesn't destroy us ecologically is if there are hugely less people very quickly. I say that's not possible. I say, therefore, that in order to have a humane future, we have to stop the trend towards robotization. Don't get me wrong, by the way, Alex. I don't believe that the currently very high and growing human population of the world is sustainable, but that's even without robot growth in numbers. I think what we need to do is find a way of gradually building down the numbers of human beings on the planet through non-authoritarian means. We need to persuade people through family planning and through thinking rationally about what will be a better human future and so on and so forth, that it would be better to have a globe on which there were 7 billion people than 10 billion, and maybe in the long run better to have one with 5 or 6 billion, and we can carry on thinking about what exactly are the best numbers, the numbers which actually add up to human life on Earth being compatible with our ecological stability, as well as being a flourishing, enjoyable life. But all you do, if you add on robots on top of that, is you make it harder and harder to have an ecologically stable and sane future. So that's why I say, no, robotization cannot go on in the way that people are talking about. And people who are thinking about things in a green kind of way have to start talking about this.
There is a whole bag full of really sharp knives in what you just said. I mean, I could see a point where the billionaires meet in a little room and decide they don't need a few billion of us. Or I could see that robots themselves would have to become consumers because we won't be able to afford the products that they make, and on and on. I have to get something in here. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Rupert Reed from the University of East Anglia. We're talking about why real action on climate change is such a struggle for all of us. Now, part of that struggle, Rupert, has been the Green Party, and particularly in Europe, it's been green politics. What has been your role in that?
Well, so I've stood a number of times for Parliament and for the European Parliament. Unfortunately, of course, we have a very inequitable political system in Britain, as we do in the US and in most countries, frankly, in the world. It's very hard for the Green Party to break through with the electoral system. And even when the electoral system is fairer, even when you have proportional representation, it's still hard for the Green Party to get fairly represented because the media are stacked against us. We don't have rich donors like most of the other parties do. So it's hard to make progress as part of the Green Party. I see the Green Party as a vital part of the chance we have, which is, I think, frankly, a slim chance, but it still exists, the chance we have of saving ourselves and returning to some kind of ecological sanity. Because we need to be acting at every level. We need to live in a different way in our day-to-day lives and in our communities. We need to act in our workplaces to try to change those. And, of course, many of us have real power as laborers, as workers, especially if we're in a trades union, as I am. And we need to act in the political system, and that means things like direct action, it means things like demonstrations and lobbying, but it crucially means elections too. I say to people sometimes, why lobby your member of parliament if you could be your member of parliament? And that's what I've sought to be, unsuccessfully as yet. Hopefully that may change in the future. We do, of course, have some brilliant elected green politicians in the UK, including at the head of us all, Caroline Lucas, our absolutely amazing member of Parliament in the Houses of Parliament for the Green Party.
Yes, indeed. Now, as you know, Rupert, every politician promises growth. We've been told the economy will collapse into massive unemployment without growth. And the Greenhouse think tank has a post-growth project. What do you mean, and how could that work?
Yeah, so this is another crucial part of the picture. As you say, Alex, unfortunately, the idea of economic growth still remains largely hegemonic. It remains largely dominant around the world and in public discourse and in the media. And this is basically a disaster. It's a continual ecological disaster in the making. Because the more growth that you have, or the more you try to bring about economic growth, the more pressure you place on ecosystems, the less room you leave for wildlife, the less room you leave for the kind of functions that the Earth performs for us in terms of regulating and absorbing pollution and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we in Greenhouse are saying we have, as a human race, and we have in our societies, to start to think beyond economic growthism. After all, what is growth supposed to be for anymore? We already live in countries like the United States, Canada, and the UK. We already live in a position where most of us, frankly, have enough. Now, of course, some of us don't have enough, but some of us have way too much. We need to share better. That's what we need to do, not grow the economy more. We need to get the rich to give up a little of what they have, and then everyone will have enough. We don't need any more economic growth. And economic growth, as I say, it simply puts more and more pressure on our vital ecosystems, without which we are nothing. Every bit of economic growth means more straining against the limits to growth, limits such as the capacity of our atmosphere to absorb pollution, limits such as the fact that raw materials, so-called, are running out. So in Greenhouse, we have this post-growth project. If people want to look at it, I'd urge them to go to our website, greenhousethinktank.org, and find out more about it. We're part of an alliance around the world, the post-growth alliance of people who are thinking the same way. And this kind of thinking is gradually starting to become acceptable as people realize that growth isn't all it's cracked up to be. People realize that it's pushing us into a completely unsustainable situation. And as people realize that there are real alternatives, we could have a society now which didn't grow anymore, which satisfied human needs, and which allowed us to be ecologically sane, ecologically stable. What's not to like? We think that this is an idea whose time has very much come, and the word needs to spread on this, and needs to spread fast.
Well, I'd like to now venture into some new territory for our listeners. You are known as a scholar of the late Ludwig Wittgenstein, and pardon my bumbling around in this. I did study it at university several decades ago, but I've forgotten almost everything about that. But I do know that in his early work in the 1920s, Wittgenstein suggested that words work by triggering pictures of facts in our minds. That was his early theory, I think. Now, there is no human memory of climate shift. Is that part of the problem? We don't have the pictures for a different climate, and so language fails.
Interesting. I think that there's something in what you've said there, definitely. I think that the way in which we have been trained to think, the scenarios that we are used to, these things are not preparing us well for the unprecedented situation of dangerous climate change. There are precedents of a sort. For example, Jared Diamond discusses them in his work, for example, his fascinating book, Collapse, How Human Societies Choose to Fail, which I think is a great title. When societies fail, it's not usually because some terrible fate simply befalls them. They do things which set themselves up for failure. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing right now. But these precedents, the kind of examples that Diamond talks about, of course, they only existed before on much smaller scales. We've never had a truly worldwide crisis before. Actually, that's not quite true. There is one hopeful precedent there, which is, of course, the ozone layer crisis, the ozone hole, which occurred in the 1980s. But that was easier to fix, and it was basically fixed, and this is why it's an encouraging precedent. That was easier to fix than the climate crisis because it didn't concern so much of what human beings do. It wasn't so integrally tied in with economic activity as a whole. So I think you're right, Alex, in saying that something which is a problem for us is that our history hasn't prepared us well for this crisis that we find ourselves in now. In terms of how Wittgenstein's thinking can contribute to this, one thing I would draw attention to is that Wittgenstein was a skeptic about the idea of human progress. Now, that might sound very unattractive to many listeners. Many listeners might think, hey, human progress, that's what it's all about. That's absolutely essential to who we are. We've got to stand behind the idea of human progress. But what Wittgenstein basically said was that he thought that the idea of progress, if that idea means something which is supposed to be continuous, and certainly if that idea is tied into material progress and material growth, is a kind of fake idea and a fake ideal, which has been actually a very recent idea. It wasn't present in most of the great societies of antiquity, for example. It simply wasn't present at all there. And Wittgenstein thinks that there are other objectives which we should place much higher than these kind of ideas of progress. He thinks that real quality of life and real quality, for example, of thought and of artistic production, that these are ideas which are better than our ideas of progress or development or growth, which have led us astray. That, I think, is an intriguing idea in Wittgenstein's philosophy, which is one that I've tried to follow up in my work in recent years.
And did he not later in his life come to the conclusion that language was not a game necessarily based on rational conclusions from the facts, but rather patterns of words with intentions to convey things like comfort or security? But then I think of Donald Trump. Maybe he's unknowingly using this failure of language to avoid the facts of climate change. But he talks about discomfort, and he tries to breed insecurity in his listeners. It's very confusing to me.
That's an idea I haven't heard before, that Donald Trump might be a Wittgensteinian. I don't think so. I think, by the way, that one of the few silver linings of the current awful political situation, and it is frankly awful, we need to be quite clear about that with ourselves, it calls for a huge response in a very different direction. I think one of the few things that's good about it is that Trump and his ilk will be thrown into the dustbin of history as it becomes clearer and clearer that dangerous climate change is happening and that they have stoked it. I actually think it's entirely possible that Trump might even flip on this issue in this year or in the next few years. For example, there are so many people in the Pentagon who are quite clear about what's happening. The Pentagon understand that human-induced climate change is the greatest security threat of our time. I think that it's hard to be a president, especially a president of the kind that Trump wants to be, who wants to put America first, who doesn't even listen to his own advisors in the Pentagon. So we'll see how that develops. In terms of how Wittgenstein's later ideas might be relevant, really I think the idea which is most crucial here, it ties in with what I was saying a couple of minutes ago about how Wittgenstein was actually skeptical about the way that we are captured by this idea of progress, is that in Wittgenstein's later work, he emphasized very much the importance of human forms of life, ways of living that we are accustomed to as the basis for anything that we do. And I think that we may come to realize more as the threat from issues such as climate rises in the coming years, and it will become more and more starkly clear to us. I think that what we are about to lose will start to come home to us. And the way that our very forms of life, our very forms of existence, and indeed language itself, are under threat by all of this, will start to become clearer to us, and that perhaps when the stakes are clearer, we will move and respond and act in a different way. Now, the problem is, Alex, that if we leave it much longer, it simply will be too late. So we have to do something smart. We have to get ahead of the curve. We have to educate ourselves. We have to spread the word. We have to put our bodies on the line sometimes. We have to put our money on the line. I would say to listeners out there who might have £10,000 or $100,000 stashed away, this money is going to be no good to you. It's going to be no good to your children if the ecological crisis comes and crunches us in the way that it's looking likely to do over the next generation. Be bold. Put that money now towards some places where it can actually do good. Put it into the political process behind people like Greens or others who have their hearts and their minds in the right place on these issues. Or put it into projects which can actually help right now to conserve the world or to grow food in a better way. I think people need to think big. This is, as we've said, an unprecedented moment in human history, and we will be judged as to whether we think big enough on it.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, one place to start on the web is at www.rupertreed.net, where you can find a link to most of my various activities. You can follow me on Twitter at Green Rupert Reed, and that's R-E-A-D. Green Rupert Reed, and I'm not too hard to find. I'm a pretty active voice out there. And, yeah, I'd love to hear from people, hear what they think of this broadcast, and I hope that we'll get more and more people joining us in what we're trying to do here. I think your radio station is very aptly named EcoShock. There is going to be a terrible EcoShock coming down the road unless we act like wise frogs and do it sooner rather than later, and I'd love to be a part of working on this with listeners.
Well, there's another part of the shock, too, intended there, and that's the sort of medical state of shock where people are in an accident and then they can't think straight for a little while. I think that's sort of where we are. We've fallen into this sort of tar pit, a trap for intelligent beings by discovering fossil fuels that stored sunlight in the earth. And I know there's quite a few YouTube videos with yourself in it, and I'm going to put links to some of your articles and YouTube videos and, of course, your site at the Greenhouse Think Tank, all that. I'll put it in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. We have been speaking with Dr. Rupert Reed. He's a reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's the chair of the Greenhouse Think Tank, as I've said, and he has been trying to be a green representative and also has often been a spokesperson for the UK Green Party. Rupert, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's really been a pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists have created complex models that project an extreme climate shift. And these models reach down into deforestation, agricultural impacts, changes to the oceans, ice worlds, and atmosphere. But now we know humans are the driving force in a new geologic age called the Anthropocene. Scientific climate models have the physics and the chemistry, but so far they lack the most difficult thing, how humans will further twist and tilt natural systems. A paper published in the National Science Review in December 2016 addresses that. This work from a team of 20 authors deals with overshoot, the trajectory of collapse, and the way growing inequality of wealth can break our system down. I've reached the lead author, Dr. Safa Modashari. He's a systems scientist at the University of Maryland. Safa Modashari, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Alex.
This new work from your team, it's deep and it's long, but before we get there, I'd like to build a base from an earlier paper you published in 2014 with Jorge Ribas and Irene Calne. And the title is Human and Nature Dynamics, Modeling Inequality and the Use of Resources in the Collapse or Sustainability of Societies. I've just talked with Dr. Cameron Petrie about the downfall of the Indus civilization a few thousand years ago. In the same program, Dr. Takeshi Inamata told us about the collapse of the Mayan society. So it does happen. Are serious people concerned about the possibility of collapse in our own civilization?
That's an interesting question, Alex. I work on dynamical systems, a field devoted to studying the properties and evolution of systems with interconnected components and variables. Collapse is characterized by fast reduction in one or many variables in that system. It's a possibility in almost any dynamic system, given certain structures and parameter values. And the human system in a specific geographical region together with its natural resources, it's a dynamic system. And therefore, it's not an exception from such possibility.
Well, now, in your 2014 paper, in the abstract, we find, quote, "We build a human population dynamics model by adding accumulated wealth and economic inequality to a predator-prey model of humans and nature." And I'm thinking these days a few billionaires are piling up the wealth while the middle class almost evaporates and poverty expands, even in developed countries. Has our society developed a class of predators and prey comparable to nature?
Right. Many people wonder about that and ask us about this issue. So within the framework of the Handy model, we consider the depletion of natural resources as a predation mechanism, similar to what was done in the theoretical model of predator-prey in biology. The stock of nature is the prey, and the stock of human population plays the role of the predator. Nonetheless, inequality by itself is included as a central element in the Handy model, in the sense that the elites, they control the stock of wealth, which allows them to live off of what the masses produce. And this gives elites a buffer in the event of a collapse. It postpones their collapse for a few years or a few decades, but it cannot save them forever.
I find that very interesting, that humans are really the predators here and the prey is nature itself. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it sounds true. So many biologists have worked out the carrying capacity for everything from wolves to plankton, but they're leaving something out, you say?
Yes, this is an important question, and it's a topic that we plan to write a more comprehensive paper about in the future. From the traditional point of view of biology or ecology, carrying capacity is a parameter, often a constant, that's determined a priori for the system. But we show that for the human system, carrying capacity is a more complex dynamic variable that's determined by the structure and the properties of the system. It's not something that we can prescribe in our models before we run them. It results from simulation of the model. And most importantly, we show that carrying capacity can change and can evolve over time as a result of policy choices and decisions, particularly decisions we make about natural resource management.
You know, something that you're saying here is stimulating a memory in me, and I can't pinpoint it, but it was about systems and the way seemingly stable systems can run for a long time, and then rather than decline, they just fell apart. Is that something that you've encountered in your model runs?
Yes, this is a very good point, actually. This brings up the issue, you know, we show that in our Handy paper. This was one of the features of the paper that made it very attractive to our academic colleagues and to the academic community and also to the public. So we showed there are two different trajectories or routes to a collapse. So one is overexploitation of nature, which we call type N collapses in our Handy paper, which is a typical case of collapses, and people have known about that before. But then we show a different route to a collapse, where initially the system, seems apparently on a steady state path, and the system is otherwise sustainable. But then we introduce a large level of inequality into the system, and after that we see that the system moves towards a collapse. So, you know, this is what we call the type L, or collapse due to overexploitation of labor. L stands for labor. And this is definitely something that we have seen in historical cases. For example, the collapse of the Maya civilization represents this mechanism fairly well.
I wonder, too, if the collapse of the Soviet Union wouldn't come under that, in the sense that people weren't getting a lot from the government that demanded everything of them, and people stopped believing in the system. There was a collapse of belief.
That's a slightly different. That's a slightly different than what we discuss, but it could be understood beyond the framework that we proposed in the Handy model.
All right, well, let's move forward to your new paper of 2016. Why did your team of 20 experts decide on this pursuit?
So current models that are used to guide important policies nationally and internationally, such as the integrated assessment models or the models used for the IPCC reports, they make projections of the climate and the rest of the Earth system variables and components based on long-term demographic and economic forecasts that are done independently. But in reality, all of these key human system components are connected with two-way feedbacks to natural components. So we propose the modeling community to shift toward a new paradigm of modeling, which is including all of these human system variables as dynamic variables in the model with bidirectional feedbacks to the Earth system components, as it is happening in the real system, in the real world. And we were really fortunate to work with a team of distinguished scientists whose expertise and background was in multiple different aspects of both the Earth system and the human system. And they helped us really put together this framework and make sure we consider different aspects that are critical in developing such a framework.
I think that's really important, what you've just said, and it's a huge topic. We're going to talk more about it as we continue this interview with Safa Modashari. So Owen Gaffney and Will Steffens were on our program. They published their equation for the operation of humans and nature in the Anthropocene. And on Radio EcoShock, Owen talked about the great acceleration seen in almost every trend of human action since 1950. Does that figure in your paper?
Absolutely. So if you look at the first figure in our paper, figure number one, we have a plot that shows the development and the trajectory of the human population and human consumption per capita since 2,000 years ago up until today. And that shows, you know, two points, basically from the beginning of industrial civilization, 1750, and then from 1950, beginning of the Green Revolution, we have two rapid periods of growth in both of these variables. And you have to remember that our total impact on the planet is the product, is the multiplication of these two. So we have two extremely rapidly growing factors, and the multiplication, the product of the two, is our total impact on the planet, which we calculate actually in that figure in the paper. And we show that since 1950 onward, every 17 years, once every 17 years, the total impact has doubled. This is shockingly rapid.
Well, in this program, we talk a lot about how feedbacks in climate change could destabilize the human system and everything from agriculture to more deaths from heat and flooding. But what about the feedbacks you're talking about that humans impose on the natural system? Is there an important interaction in all this?
That's an excellent question, Alex. So we devoted a major portion of the paper to discussing these feedbacks in both directions. So most of the literature, academic literature, and most what we people know about are the impacts that the human system has on the planet. You know, with the impact on the climate, impact on oceans, on land, and so on and so forth. But we look at also there are feedbacks, impacts of the Earth system on the human system, on the society. And we discuss that, you know, we discuss this in details in the paper.
These Earth system models, they're huge models running on multiple computers and great big computing centers, and they're used by groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and many other institutions, and that's what advises governments when they do a deal like the Paris Agreement. From what you're saying, it sounds like these models are missing an essential part of the picture. Maybe they're way off on what's going to happen.
Yes, that's a critical point, and that's the central message of our paper. So these models and these people who run these models, they are very talented and brilliant people, and these models are very detailed and complicated model, and they've accomplished a lot. But the key factor is that we need to have those feedbacks, the bidirectional feedbacks between the human elements and the Earth system, the natural elements, in order to get realistic projections of the future. There are many scenarios, many situations that we can miss, important signals indeed, that we can miss if we don't include these feedbacks. And we really hope that these institutions and these large organizations that run these models and already have the capacity and the talent and the tools necessary to implement such models actually take our proposed paradigm and implement it in their own models.
Safa, I have to sympathize, though, with climate scientists, especially under pressure of denial coming out of the Trump administration. Earth scientists are comfortable modeling ice melt and ocean currents. Those are physical events with solid numbers. Is it fair to ask them to add in the rapidly changing human economy as well?
Right. That's, again, another one of the central points of the paper. And this question is raised a lot. We are arguing in the paper that because humans have become the major drivers of the changes in the natural systems and the Earth system, understanding long-term trajectory of natural system can no longer be done accurately without including these effects from the human system. So we must model the human system as well. We have to do it. Of course, you know, this is not a trivial task. This is not obvious. And it's stepping out of the comfort zone of the natural scientists or Earth system scientists. But it's something that has to be done, and we have to start as soon as possible. It's a learning curve, but the more we delay it, the more dangers we might be facing.
Well, let's say we don't take your advice. We stick to basic science and leave the hot political issues like fair distribution of wealth right out of the models. What happens?
Yeah, this is precisely the issue of the feedback. We cannot ignore these feedbacks anymore and just assume that everything will be fine, which is the assumption of independent projections. We have to have those variables in the model, and we have to think about them as coupled with the rest of the system.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Dr. Safa Modashari from the University of Maryland. We're talking about the interaction of human systems with climate and a strained ecosphere. Safa, could you give us an example of the sort of human shift that could do serious damage to an Earth system model if it's not included?
Yes. Obvious example is this explosive growth of human population and the massive use of fossil fuels, what we have already seen since 1950. And this is what we show in the first graph of the paper. And that's an obvious example. There are many other examples. There are many other projections that can change the per capita consumptions and change in the standard of living and so on and so forth. But the obvious example is what has happened in the history in the recent past.
Well, I want to tell you, Dr. Timothy Garrett from the University of Utah created an equation for the relationship of wealth to emissions. He told us the only serious reduction of emissions in any country happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. Garrett's formula suggests only a global crash of our current economy could save us from extreme climate change. What are your thoughts on this, Safa?
I am an optimist, and in theory, I do not agree with this thesis that there's no way to prevent catastrophic climate change unless there's a global massive crash of the current world or current economy. We already have, you know, given our current technologies and other means, we already have all the means necessary to avoid catastrophic environmental change. The important question, the important issue is that whether we would widely adopt these technologies and solutions. And the second important thing is that whether we do it in time. We can't wait until it's too late. We have to do it as soon as possible. The sooner, the better. And this is certainly doable. But, you know, of course, if we keep doing business as usual, we don't make changes that are necessary, then the economy and the human system will automatically crash, at least in certain regions.
Is it possible this civilization has already begun a process of collapse, but we just don't know it yet?
We have to be careful about the boundary of the system when we talk about collapses. Do we mean collapse in a city, in a province, in a country, or in a larger region like the Middle East, or the collapse of the whole world? We have to always draw the boundary. Of course, there are several examples of current collapses, you know, countries that have collapsed. Most important one, most famous one is Syria, but there are several others like Somalia, Yemen, Congo, Sudan, and many other failed states.
Yes, I'd add Venezuela to that list, or at least it's in the process of collapsing, it appears, at this time. We talked about the billionaires who control most of the world's wealth, and there are billions of people who continue in abject poverty. Is it fair to say that wealth inequality is also an environmental issue now?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a great point, Alex. And this is absolutely true. We discuss in the paper, and we show even like the earlier paper, that it's not just, you know, one number about, you know, how much, you know, what's the average, what's the number. It's the distribution of wealth and consumption and emissions that matters. And the more skewed this distribution is, the larger the inequality, the impact, the total emissions, the total consumption, and the total impact on the planet is higher. So, yes, definitely this is a key issue.
I don't think most environmentalists realize that yet, although they may be on board with the issue of wealth inequality. Can you locate that same wealth inequality as a driver of collapse in any earlier human civilization?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, this was one of the main points of our handy paper that we discussed. There was, for example, the Mayan collapse, which was a case of type L collapse, which was a result of high levels of inequality, and also the collapse of the Roman empires and many others that happened certainly because of high rates of inequality.
Is there a realistic way to fix it, to right the economic injustice?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't discuss those. We're not experts on how to do this, and so we don't discuss those in the papers, but there are definitely ways, and there are experts who do that, who discuss, you know, different ways that are possible. But we show that if we do reduce this level of inequality, then we can bring the system into a steady state and a sustainable state.
Interesting. So where do the big computer models of Earth systems get their information now on demographics and economics, and what's wrong with that way of doing things?
Great question. So IAM's integrated assessment models usually use the projections by international organizations such as the United Nations for demographic projections and the World Bank for economic projections and similar other projections. The problem is that many non-trivial solutions, many non-trivial trajectories of the whole system cannot be derived from these exogenous projections. Those variables like population or consumption inequality can go only one way in this way of doing the models, in this like one-way coupled models, which is the projected way. You project it, so that's the only way that it can evolve over time. There is no other way. But in reality, those variables can evolve in many different ways and many non-trivial, surprising trajectories and solutions can emerge.
And you talk about human system models. I'm dubious that's possible with billions of quasi-intelligent and randomly creative or destructive beings. Who has those models and how good are they?
This is probably the most common doubt people have with our proposed framework. So you're absolutely right. We cannot model human choices and predict what people will do, at least, you know, at this time and with the current stage of models of human cognition and decision making. And because of that, we don't discuss it in the paper. Rather, we take policies as choices, as knobs that you can tweak, and you can, based on those choices, based on those policies, you can get different trajectories and different outcomes in the future.
Safa, have you found resistance among Earth scientists to incorporating the work on human systems?
Fortunately, most Earth scientists and natural scientists that we have collaborated or communicated with agree with our thesis about coupling these systems, Earth and human systems, with feedbacks. Maybe not all of them would like to be actively involved in the implementation process because this would be, you know, out of their comfort zone. But few disagree with the importance of including these feedbacks in the systems. And we received, you know, massive support from our peers and our academic colleagues in terms of the future direction of the modeling community.
I've been thinking about your paper over a few days, and if I were a politician supported by fundraising from rich people and corporations, the tone of your team's paper is almost revolutionary. I mean, economic justice is not on the agenda right now. We're not hearing about it in the TV news. It's something for lefties maybe or smaller governments in South America to talk about. But again, just so we don't miss it in the political fog, what happens if we ignore what is happening with wealth distribution?
You're right. You're right. The issue of inequality does not seem to be on the agenda for the politicians. And I wouldn't agree that it's not for common people. You know, people can see the dangers from these high levels of inequality, and we need to include them. So we should, and we should certainly in the future and currently discuss more inequality and its implications, particularly from a purely scientific point of view, you know, from a point of view of what happens if these levels of inequality increase, what happens to the system, to both, you know, the human system and the natural system.
Is anybody already working to combine these human systems to the integrated assessment models that are used to advise governments and corporations?
I don't know personally any group or institution that's currently providing policy advice using two-way coupled models. So that's why we're proposing that we need to have those, and we hope that the institutions that are currently using one-way coupled models, they move toward this new paradigm of modeling that we propose.
And what will you be researching next?
So a couple of things. So one of the things, important things that we are working on right now is the natural follow-up to the current paper. So in the current paper, we showed basically a framework. We proposed a framework to couple the Earth system and human system. But we have actually developed also an example of this model. It's a coupled human climate water model. And we have validated it with the past observations. It runs for the region of Phoenix in Arizona. And we are preparing a manuscript based on that for submission to a scientific journal. And following that, we are also hoping to write, you know, as I discussed earlier, we're hoping to write an introduction to carrying capacity, to the concept of carrying capacity from the point of view of dynamic systems and the introducing carrying capacity as a dynamic variable for human systems.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Two points that I always like to raise when I discuss my work. One thing is that always preventing catastrophes is much cheaper and much easier done before they occur compared to fixing the results and consequences of catastrophes. That's why, you know, that's why we try to develop these models. We try to discuss these issues before they happen and propose solutions that are relatively easy to implement, cheap to implement, and they can have the best, it's the win-win situation for everyone. So that's one point. And the second point is that I think the key for successfully doing this, for successfully making these right decisions before, you know, catastrophes happen, is education. Is education at its widest definition, both formal education as it's done, you know, in school and colleges, and also education through media. That's exactly why we need, you know, many great journalists like yourself to communicate, you know, science and evidence unbiased to the public and inform them. And because of that, I really like to congratulate you for your great work and thank you for talking with me about this.
Well, I appreciate that. We've been talking about a big new paper from a team of 20 scientists The title is Modeling Sustainability, Population, Inequality, Consumption, and Bidirectional Coupling of the Earth and Human Systems. It's a big title, but I think it's kind of revolutionary, and that's why I'm glad we had this chance to talk about it. It was published in the National Science Review in December 11th, 2016. You can find links to the science discussed in this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest is Dr. Safa Modashari, the systems scientist from the University of Maryland. Safa, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now that's a loaded hour. Good for you for going all the way. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're very fortunate today. We're going to be speaking to Rick Sterling in California about the presentation of an Oscar last night for the White Helmets. And Rick has written about that. We'll also talk to Norman Otis Richmond about the James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. And in the latter half of the program, we'll be talking to Stephen Gowans about Syria and Gallen's new book. But I think we have Rick Sterling on the line. Are you there, Rick? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, Phil.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Rick. You, as far as I'm concerned, wrote the definitive piece about the group called the White Helmets, and it could be found in Consortium News, I think only a few days ago. Were you surprised they got an Oscar?
No, I wasn't, actually. I think they were the odds-on favorite. There's a ton of money pushing their nomination, and it aligns politically as well. So money and politics have quite a bit of sway in Hollywood.
I'm afraid you're right. There's a lot of myths about that. The White Helmets, as they're called, and there's another label, the Serious Civil Defense. They're always described as independent. Are they independent?
No, absolutely not. They were created by a British military contractor, James Le Mesurier, with U.S. and U.K. funding just 3.5, 4 years ago, actually, in 2013. So, and they're that involved some training in Turkey, and then their political alignment was also was very clear right from the beginning, because their leadership, when they came to the United States, they spoke and had editorials calling for greater U.S. and NATO intervention, direct intervention in Syria. So they're not independent politically. They're not independent economically.
Yeah. By the way, Hollywood seemed to want to make this a matter of Trump, but it was the Obama administration, was it not, who first sort of intercepted one of their representatives and prevented his entry to the U.S.?
That is correct. And I think there's a bit of a my interpretation of that is there's a conflict within the State Department and the Defense Department over the Syria policy. So that when Rod Saleh was due to come to the U.S. to receive an award last spring or early summer, his visa was revoked. And as you say, this was under the Obama administration. And that raised a lot of questions. I mean, how are they touting this organization and they won't even allow the leader of it to come into the country? And that, of course, was repeated just in the last week, when the filmmaker who did some of the photography from inside Aleppo, his visa was not approved at the end. There were reports that he had actually been arrested in Turkey. So we don't yet know the whole story there. But the bottom line is that this group is directly affiliated with terrorists, with Al-Qaeda's Syria branch. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. That's who they work with. Their headquarters in East Aleppo, when it was controlled by the terrorists, was right alongside the headquarters of the Jabhat al-Nusra, the major terrorist group in Aleppo. Mm-hmm. They had Nusra logos on the walls inside the White Helmets training center. So there's a direct connection there. And there's lots of photographs also showing individuals with their White Helmet uniform and then showing them with weapons and with waving Nusra flags.
Yeah. We're talking to Rick Sterling, and his article is Syrian War Propaganda at the Oscars, and as you find it at Consortium News. They also are called volunteers, and I remember from your article that they're not, in fact, volunteers. Is that right?
That's another untruth about them among the many. In fact, when they found documentation showing the payments that were being made to the White Helmets, including their video team, because they never go anywhere without without a video team. That's mostly what it's about. But ironically, Al Jazeera did a short video about the White Helmets just in the last 6 months. And within the video, they show some of them in talking about possibly going on strike because they weren't paid in the previous month. So so much for the volunteers.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an amazing story. Since they won the Oscars last night, There's been a flood of congratulations from all the usual mm-hmm. people who've been involved in promoting the war on Syria, from Samantha Powers to Amnesty International. It's tragic, but Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they are part of they're kind of the fifth wheel of the war on Syria, mm-hmm. where they're heavily promoting the propaganda and caring and the information war, making huge accusations without evidence against the Syrian government. And that's a big part of what the White Helmets are. It's a brilliant marketing scheme, and it's a brilliant mind manipulation in a way, because it sounds so good. Here are these unarmed volunteers. They're independent politically. They don't want to be involved in the fighting. They just want to rescue people. It's very appealing and attractive, and that's why it's been so successful, along with being boosted by about $100 million, which can help a lot.
$100 million goes a long way. By the way, one of the things that certainly concerned me, when I follow it, I don't understand. They could call themselves civil defense. But there is a civil defense
that's right.
in
that's
Syria,
right.
And there's also exactly, Red Crescent. Why are they never mentioned?
That's exactly right, Phil. And Vanessa Beely has done more than anybody that I'm aware of to expose the White Helmets. And she was in Aleppo. She's been in Aleppo numerous times over the last year and a half. And she did on-the-ground interviews with the real Syria civil defense, which goes back to the 1950s, which is the official member of the International Civil Defense Organizations, and this hoax group stole the name, mm-hmm. you know, with British funding and this British military contractor training some individuals in Turkey. They stole the name Syria Civil Defense, and then the next year, when the marketing gurus took control, they rebranded it as the White Helmets. They thought that was a jazzier name.
Yes.
Ironically, even that name is stolen because there's an Argentinian group called Cascos Blancos or White Helmets. Yeah. But that's the amazing thing.
Not with State Department money. Yeah.
They stole the name, and when the terrorists invaded Aleppo in the summer of 2012, they took over neighborhoods. And when the real Syria civil defense came in to put out fires and to rescue people after combat, the terrorists killed real civil defense workers and stole their equipment. Mm-hmm. So that's how it began, or that was the origins of it.
Yes.
And then it was think about this. here's an organization that began in 2013 officially with this British military contractor in alliance with the terrorists in mostly in northern Syria. In the span of 4 years, they have been seriously nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. They won the Rights Livelihood Award, and then last night they won a an Academy Award as the best short documentary for this infomercial. That's what it really is. It's a very poor movie. If you take the trouble to watch it, it's like 35 minutes long or something like that. It's very thin. It's very contrived. They spend a fair bit of time in Turkey showing the so-called white helmets talk on their cell phones phoning home.
By the way, I think you pointed out in your article, this is in a way fronted by Europeans or others. None of the people called directors, producers, they weren't in Syria. This is actually a white helmets product. It has been laundered through others?
Well, the two filmmakers, Von Eisendel and Netsagara, they did some footage in Turkey, but that's correct. They didn't set foot in Syria, and the bit of footage there is from inside Syria was provided by the White Helmets, and it looks, frankly, it looks very contrived if you watch it.
Well, they do a meme where they played a little game and pretended they were standing still?
Right.
Isn't that sort of self-parody?
Yeah, I think that was one example where it was blatantly, obviously, they were acting and they were faking it, but I think a lot of their footage is actually faked. That's been suggested, a lot of it looks contrived, to be honest.
Last question, Rick Sterling, and the article, by the way, is in Consortium News. Everybody should read that in light of this Oscar. Is this a sign that the Hillary type or the neoliberals are doubling down on regime change? Are they intend to try to remove the government of Syria?
Well, I think the jury's still out. We don't know which way the new Trump administration is going to go, if Trump is going to do what he said he was going to do, which was to back off on regime change, or if he's going to basically comply with the neocons and Israel and Saudi Arabia and do, just like you say, double down. It's going to be horrendous if they do. Because it'll just extend the bloodshed and the war and everything else. And by the way, White Helmet, since they were expelled along with the terrorists from East Aleppo, and 90% of the civilians who were in East Aleppo, there was about 110 or 120,000. There weren't any 300 or 400,000 as was claimed at the time. But 90% of them went rushing into the government-controlled area for protection there. So that's what's going on. But since that time, the terrorists and the White Helmets joined with other rebel militants in Barada Valley in the mountains above Damascus, poisoned the water supply, and then blocked the water supply for 5 million people.
Oh my God!
And then Vanessa has pointed out that now they've shown up for the first time in Homs, the city of Homs, which is 98% controlled by the government. There's just a small terrorist enclave there from which they're still doing car bombs and doing explosions and attacks. And now the White Helmets have shown up there as well.
Bad sign. Maybe they'll make a zombie movie. Rick Sterling, it's a great article. It's in Consortium News. We thank you very, very much.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Phil. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Martin of Peace Action, who takes a critical look at President Trump's revised travel ban that targets travelers and refugees from six majority Muslim nations. James S. Henry, a longtime investigator of corrupt international banking and illegal tax havens, who discusses the connections he's uncovered between Donald Trump, a Russian oligarch, the Bank of Cyprus, and newly confirmed Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and Linda Anderson, director of the group Bold Nebraska, who talks about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline after the Trump administration announced it is seeking to revive the project. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 25 years after the Berlin Wall fell, Russia is pushing back against perceived aggression from the United States and European powers. The resistance surged in 2014 with Moscow's annexation of Crimea and engagement in the civil conflict in eastern Ukraine. Under President Vladimir Putin, Russia has increased its clout in the Middle East and Latin America, far beyond the borders of the states of the former Soviet Union. Andrei Klimov, a member of Russia's upper house of parliament, declared Russia is not some regional dwarf, but a world power with its own zone of influence. Russia's clout is clearly felt in Syria, where Putin has backed Moscow's old ally, Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad, who faces continuing rebellion from foes, including militias backed by the U.S. Putin used his nation's military might to oust rebels during the siege of Aleppo. Russia's interest in the outcome of the war in Syria is linked with its long-term leases at the Syrian port of Tartus and the airbase at Latakia, which gives Moscow strategic launch points for future military operations in the Middle East. A resolution before the UN Security Council on February 28th would have imposed sanctions against Syrian officials involved in dropping chlorine-filled barrel bombs against opposition forces. However, the sanctions initiative, backed by the Trump administration, France, and England, failed when it was vetoed by both Russia and China. In a major win for immigrant rights advocates, Houston's Sheriff Ed Gonzalez dropped out of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement 287G program, which deputizes local police to act as immigration officers. In January, President Trump signed an executive order that included measures to expand the 287G program. Gonzalez, a Democrat, will reassign 10 sheriff's deputies who are responsible for assessing the immigration status of jailed suspects and holding them for deportation. During last fall's election campaign for Harris County Sheriff, Gonzalez called ICE's 287G program a violation of due process rights that leads to racial profiling, the separation of families, and mistrust of deputies. Under 287G, databases are checked for immigration status on minor infractions such as traffic violations. According to the Guardian newspaper, only 37 police departments in 16 states are currently participating in the 287G program. With 4 million residents in Greater Houston, Harris County was the most populous major city enrolled in the program before Sheriff Gonzalez severed ties with ICE. Maine state legislators have attempted five times to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, formerly known as the Affordable Care Act. However, each time Tea Party Governor Paul LePage has vetoed the bill, the legislature could not muster enough votes to override the veto. To bypass LePage's opposition, a new statewide coalition called Mainers for Healthcare is campaigning for a statewide ballot question to expand Medicaid coverage. If approved by voters, Maine would be required to accept federal dollars to expand healthcare coverage for the state's poor. Thus far, the coalition has collected over 60,000 signatures, more than enough to put the measure on this year's ballot. Yet it could be blocked if Republicans in Congress quickly repeal Obamacare. Maine is one of the poorest states in the nation. Under Medicaid expansion, 70,000 Mainers would gain access to health care, where it's estimated that 3,000 new health care jobs would be created. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump issued a revised travel ban on March 6th, more than a month after his initial January 27th executive order, provoked massive protests at airports from coast to coast. What many labeled as Trump's Muslim ban suspended entry of all refugees to the United States for 120 days and prohibited travel from seven Muslim-majority nations for 90 days. The order also blocked all refugees from Syria indefinitely and reduced the total number of refugees admitted into the U.S. during the 2017 fiscal year to 50,000, down from the previous cap of 110,000. In response to the filing of lawsuits, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit blocked key provisions of that travel ban based on likely violations of the U.S. Constitution. The new order, which takes effect on March 16th, maintains a 90-day ban on travel to the U.S., by citizens of six of the seven original nations targeted, dropping Iraq. Travelers from Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen are affected, but the new ban exempts citizens from these countries who are legal U.S. permanent residents or have valid visas to enter the U.S., including those whose visas were revoked during the original implementation of the ban. Many immigration advocates said that Trump's revised ban still discriminated against Muslims and failed to address some concerns with the previous order. Joanne Lynn, the ACLU's senior legislative counsel, pledged that the group will pursue all legal remedies through the courts and elsewhere to make sure the new executive order won't go into effect on March 16th. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Martin, president of the group Peace Action, who takes a critical look at Trump's revised travel ban, explaining why he believes the measure makes the country less safe.
Well, I think they're playing a game of political chicken here. I guess I'll start with that first, because to me, I think that's more important than the substance. It was somewhat tweaked to possibly address some of the legal concerns, but also some of the protest and the backlash. And in that regard, people who have been resisting this awful travel ban, Muslim ban, you know, should feel somewhat good that the administration was forced to back off a little bit. But my sense is they're playing political chicken in that they tweaked it enough so they can claim it's different and say that they are trying to address the problems. And, of course, they would never admit this, but they rushed it forward before, and it was a naked Muslim ban, and that was what they were trying to fulfill, a campaign promise. I think they are banking on the courts having such deference to the presidency, to the executive branch, that they will let this slide, that the courts will not once again try to strike it down. That's just my guess. That's just speculation. But I think that's what they think. They think, well, you know, we'll back off just an inch or two, and the courts are going to defer to the president. They're not going to tell the president no twice. That's what I think is going on here politically.
What do you think the response should be from people who are rightly outraged at Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, where he talked about banning Muslims blatantly? And, of course, that first executive order put that campaign rhetoric into action. Now, this may be a little diluted, a little more subtle, but the objectives, according to a lot of people who are looking at this new executive order, I think it's really the same thing in new packaging. What do you think the response should be from civil society to this thing?
Well, I think that's very true. And I think people should not be giving an inch. They should say, well, it was wrong before, and this slightly tweaked version is also wrong, but should also have some confidence that we can win or that we are winning. So I just happened to scan a few colleague organizations to see what their statements were today, as well as our organizational statement about this. And the four or five that I checked out are all still condemning this Muslim ban 2.0. But one, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the one thing that they did put in it was that folks who had resisted the first version of it should feel confident that this was a bit of a victory, not necessarily substantively, because they only changed a few things. They dropped Iraq from the seven countries, it's now six. It won't affect permanent green card holders. They say it's only going to be temporary for 120 days, which is what the other one said too, but it's clear, at least for some of the countries, they're going to try to make it permanent. So substantively wasn't that much different, but again, CARE was saying that people that resisted the first one should feel that this is a bit of a victory politically, that the administration had to back off a little bit, but they're not at all advocating that people be quiet about it. They're still advocating militant resistance and opposition.
One of the rationales for this Muslim ban, both during the campaign and when the first executive order was issued, was to say there's an urgency to stopping travel from certain countries because they pose a dire threat to the United States. Now, all that seemed to be laughable from the fact that when the federal court that actually struck down this initial travel ban asked the Trump administration to produce evidence to back up their claim that this was urgent for national security, they could not produce anything. And now, of course, this new travel ban, 2.0, looks to be a gradual kind of weeks-long implementation and doesn't seem at all urgent.
Well, that's very true, but it's also they've had to deal with contradictions, fact-based contradictions, which, of course, they don't like very much, from the government. So even the Department of Homeland Security, Trump's own, advisors now in DHS, said in a recent report that a person's country of citizenship is unlikely to be a reliable indicator of potential terrorist activity. That was a quote. And the other thing, too, is the horrible irony that four of these six countries, the United States is engaged in militarily. So we're helping to create refugees from some of these countries. It is just Orwellian. You don't have to listen to peaceniks like me. You have like hard-nosed national security experts with whom I would not agree about a lot of things saying not only is this not going to achieve what the purported reason for it is, it's going to make America less safe. This is feeding into radical extremist groups thinking that the United States hates Muslims. ISIS has called this the blessed ban. So that tells you a lot right there in terms of the counterproductivity of this. And it really has nothing to do with making Americans safer. It's part of this very fearful, racist xenophobia that I don't want our country, our society to be known for.
That was Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's revised travel ban by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Of the many disturbing questions hanging over the presidency of Donald Trump, perhaps the most potentially serious is the yet unknown connections between Trump, officials in his campaign, and billionaire oligarchs linked to the Russian government. Trump's consistently uncritical views of Russian President Vladimir Putin stand in stark contrast to the bipartisan enmity expressed toward Moscow that's been prevalent in Washington in most of the years since the end of the Cold War. With U.S. intelligence agencies concluding that Moscow had hacked America's 2016 presidential election in an attempt to damage Hillary Clinton's campaign and boost Trump, repeated statements by the president and other White House staff that they had no contact with Russian officials have proven false. Through press reports, it's been revealed that senior Trump associates had met or spoken with Russia's U.S. Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the campaign, including Trump himself, Trump's senior aide Jared Kushner, ousted National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, advisors J.D. Gordon, Carter Page, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had denied any meetings under oath during his Senate confirmation hearing. But parallel investigations have revealed another set of Trump-Russian relationships linked to the real estate billionaire's financial investments. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and Global Justice Fellow at Yale University, who discusses the connections he's uncovered between Trump, Russian oligarch Dmitry Rebolovlev, the Bank of Cyprus, and newly confirmed Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross.
Well, I come to this story with a strong interest in offshore banking, and Cyprus has for over a decade been the principal conduit of what's called round-tripping. It's where Russian investors, to protect their assets, they take and book their investments into Russia by way of Cyprus companies or trusts. And they also use Cyprus banks because Cyprus is a member of the EU since 2004. It uses the euro currency since 2008. And so there's a lot of Russian money that's been flowing through Cyprus banks. In 2013, this came to a head because the Cyprus banking system basically collapsed. There had been so much funny money coming out of Russia into Cyprus. And they had invested this in things like Greek bonds and in all kinds of dubious real estate projects, that the banking system was something like 12 times GDP in terms of total exposure and total debt. And the banking system collapsed. At that point, it came to light that the largest bank in Cyprus was basically filled to the rim with Russian deposits, and they compensated the Russian shareholders who lost their deposits in the banking crisis by giving them shares in the bank. So the Bank of Cyprus basically became majority Russian-owned. But they needed someone to kind of turn this situation around for the bank, and Wilbur Ross is an American investor who's had, you know, some people call him a vulture capitalist, some of them call him the turnaround king. In any case, he came in with a group of U.S. and European investors and invested enough to acquire 17% of the shares of the Bank of Cyprus. You know, nothing wrong with that except that what you're doing basically is turning around a bank that intrinsically is only kind of business plan is to launder money for Russians and half of its shareholders at that point, and still are probably at least a third of the shares of the bank are owned by Russian investors, and including some very well-known oligarchs. The largest investor to this day in the Bank of Cyprus is a fellow named Viktor Vekselberg, who is basically the aluminum czar. He owns quite a few companies, but his dominant position is in the aluminum industry. By any stretch of the imagination, he is a GARC, and he owns 9.3% of the Bank of Cyprus. The other two investors, one was at the time Ross invested, and for the next year and a half, was a former KGB agent appointed to his position by Putin. Vekselberg and this fellow, who was vice chairman of the bank with Ross, were both appointed by Putin, in fact, to those positions. And the third fellow is a guy who had bought Donald Trump's house in Florida in 2008, a fellow named Rebolovlev, who was the potash czar at that time of Russia. So here you have all these various Russian interests, you know, sort of crowded into this bank. The bank also had a tremendous reputation and to this day seems to be engaged in money laundering. So, you know, and who did he bring in? Ross personally brought in to run the bank the former head of Deutsche Bank, Joseph Ackermann, who had presided over a period of profound impropriety at Deutsche Bank, which Deutsche Bank is really struggling still to this day. I think they just announced an effort to raise capital this week. But their latest fine was for laundering $10 billion of Russian dirty money through New York and Cyprus, for which they got a $650 million fine in January. So bringing in this particular guy to run the Bank of Cyprus sort of raised questions, particularly since Deutsche Bank is the one global bank that loaned money to Donald Trump and is still his largest creditor. So what I've concluded from all this is that, you know, we don't have a smoking gun. There's nothing necessarily illegal. We should be cautious about drawing any firm conclusions about this stuff. But I also did an article for the American Interest in December, which pointed out Trump's extensive connections with lots of folks who are basically, sort of very close to the Russian mafia. So it isn't just a question of, Putin and the spying that the 17 intelligence agencies concluded constituted interference in the U.S. election. This involves private connections and money flowing out of Russia, round tripped back into Russia, or being invested in Trump's projects. Stuff that really, I think deserves to be investigated by Congress or by a commission.
That was James S. Henry, a longtime investigator of corrupt international banking and illegal tax havens, who serves as a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Find links to Henry's recent articles on Trump-Russia connections by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In his first week in office, Donald Trump issued executive orders to expedite construction of the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline. When President Obama halted the project, the Dakota Pipeline was almost finished, and now with a green light from the Trump administration, is nearing completion of the last section under the Missouri River. Construction of the Keystone XL Pipeline has not yet begun. After years of grassroots organizing along the pipeline route in and around the country, in November 2015, President Obama denied a key permit for the project to cross from Canada into the U.S. After taking office, Trump invited TransCanada, the company that wants to build the Keystone Pipeline, to reapply for a permit. The company did so, proposing the same route that was denied by Obama. Now the project application is back before the State Department, led by former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson, a company that is heavily involved in tar sands development in Alberta that would feed the Keystone Pipeline. A decision on the application is expected in the next few months. If built, the pipeline would run from Alberta, Canada, through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska, where it would connect to an existing pipeline to deliver 830,000 barrels a day of the dirtiest form of oil on the planet to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Linda Anderson, director of Bold Nebraska, one of the groups that led opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline in the past, with creative grassroots strategies that united ranchers and farmers and worked with indigenous opponents of the project. Here, Anderson observes that with the new oil industry-friendly Trump administration, her group has had to change their tactics.
There was a lot of pressure on Obama to kind of end the fight on that pipeline. Us, including a large coalition of people, environmentalists, people who are against eminent domain for private gain, a huge group of people, natives, they all were putting a lot of pressure. And I think the pressure just became a little more insurmountable because it was just building up and building up and building up. I mean, we are going to put pressure on Trump, but more so on the Nebraska Public Service Commission and legislators, senators, and people like that. Before, we had sort of an ally in Obama, sort of how we saw it. And this time around, we don't really have an ally in the White House. You know, we've never actually gone through the Public Service Commission process before because the last time TransCanada filed, but then they immediately tried to get eminent domain, which is illegal. So we immediately went to court to stop them from trying to do that. This time, they're sort of playing by the rules, which means that we have to go through the Public Service Commission process. So it's looking different for everybody.
What's the role of the Public Service Commission in Nebraska?
TransCanada has to file an application through the Public Service Commission. So the Public Service Commission has to either approve or deny the application. So it's really up to them on whether or not this pipeline goes through.
Do you think you have any allies there?
We know for sure that we have at least one ally, but as far as the other four, we kind of, because there's five people on the Public Service Commission, we have to kind of figure out where they're at and appeal to them and their sensibility. Nebraska is a very conservative state, and we have a lot of libertarians in this state, and they love free market, as you know. So we sort of have to convince libertarians or people that lean that way that this is eminent domain for private gain, and that's not a good thing. It's not good for the general public. There's people that we can convince on an environmental basis.
Linda Anderson, I understand you're at the state capitol right now at a hearing to put a moratorium on wind turbines in the Sand Hills region. Is there any connection to the Keystone XL project?
No, it's a totally separate issue. It's actually a Republican senator that's proposing this bill to put a moratorium on wind energy. And it's really interesting. There's a lot of Republicans that are on the committee that's hearing this bill today, and they keep talking about the fragile grounds of the Sand Hills, and it's fascinating to all of a sudden hear them care. Because before, you know, if you ask them any other time, if we're talking about, you know, oil pipelines, it doesn't seem like they care. But with wind energy, they all of a sudden care about the ecosystem there. Bold Nebraska is taking a neutral stance on that simply because we feel that they should not just put a moratorium on wind energy in the Sand Hills, but they should also put a moratorium on any projects in the Sand Hills, because it is a very fragile ecosystem that would end up affecting the aquifer. It would affect the ground. It would affect the animals and wildlife.
Is Bold Nebraska opposed to the Keystone XL no matter what, or would you be fine with it if it didn't run through Nebraska?
We're opposed to pipelines in general. Bold Nebraska is an arm of a larger entity called Bold Alliance, and we're actually fighting pipelines in several different states. We firmly believe that it's now time, in fact, it's past time, to move to clean energy. And, you know, it's interesting, we're at this bill with the wind energy, you know, LB 504, where they're opposing wind energy, and we're at a neutral stance because we do care about the Sand Hills. However, we are proponents of wind energy in other circumstances, and we're huge proponents of solar. Like I said, it's time to move on from fossil fuels.
Are you thinking of reconstituting the coalition you had fighting the Keystone XL, like the Cowboy Indian Alliance, Ranchers and Farmers, and national environmental groups like 350?
Yep, we are working on bringing all of those groups back together and more, because obviously since we've had a regime change, there's been a lot more groups that have come about, more progressive-oriented groups, so we'll bring them in and work with as many groups as possible in the intervening process so that we can make sure the Public Service Commission knows that Nebraskans are against this pipeline.
That was Linda Anderson, director of the group Bold Nebraska. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project, including a map of the proposed pipeline route, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Len Stewart, people's lawyer, freedom fighter, presente. Len Stewart, after 78 winters in America, has died after battling for years against breast cancer. But that was just some of her battles. And like most of us, she won some and she lost some. But she never stopped fighting. For decades, her and husband Ralph fought for New York's political activists and revolutionaries, like Black Panthers and Young Lords, a Puerto Rican socialist collective. But mostly, they fought for the freedom of the poor and dispossessed of New York, black and brown ghettos. They fought often and fought well. Her husband Ralph was a stalwart of the Black Panther Party and her most committed defender. When Len was targeted by the U.S. Justice Department and she was tried and convicted for putting out a press release for her client, the blind Egyptian sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, Ralph stood in the hot Washington, D.C. sun with a sign in front of the White House demanding his wife's release. Her defense of her client was in the best tradition of criminal defense lawyers, and she received significant support from a broad swath of the bar. From lawyers, yes. Judges, no. Initially sentenced to 28 months, the Second Circuit sent it back for resentencing, and she got 10 years. Her movement only grew. The late activist lawyer William Kunstler once said that defense lawyers should be officers of their clients instead of officers of the court. Len Stewart was an officer of her clients, a people's lawyer, beloved and respected. May she ever be so. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Good afternoon, Mumia. What a pleasure this is.
It is a pleasure for us both, I hope.
I think so.
You have been, seems to me, singled out by the highest levels of the Justice Department for something that was not a crime, either now or even up until the signing of the infamous Patriot Act. Would you tell me what that was?
The Justice Department decided that things that I did as a lawyer are now to be outlawed, are now to be made into crimes in order to deter other lawyers from vigorously defending people. What I basically did was I issued a press release on behalf of my client. They said that this press release was a materially aiding a terrorist organization. And as they have accused so many others recently of that same crime, it seems to have no bounds whatsoever and can be used just about for anything.
So was this essentially illegal communication with your client?
Well, they had put on us a certain prison regulation. This is something Leonard Pelletier also suffers under in the federal system. It's called a special administrative measure, which lawyers and clients, not clients, but people that we represent, must sign on to say that you will not communicate with the press on behalf of your client, thus making it impossible for any First Amendment right to be protected. In other words, Sheikh Omar was entombed in Minnesota. He was not allowed to communicate with anyone but his lawyers and his wife in Egypt once a month. We, in contravention of these regulations, did make press releases on his behalf, but it is only now that that has become an indictable offense.
Isn't this kind of a, on its face, violation of the First Amendment?
Isn't it? I couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, they hide everything behind that cloak of security within the prison, and now, of course, security for the whole nation. They are going to be the protectors of Americans, they who have done so much to make it impossible to protect this nation.
So is it not also a fact that the U.S. government, through the Justice Department, monitored your communications with your client?
Yes, this press release was in May of 2000. For the next 6 months, they went back and forth about whether they would let me in the prison again. They finally said, oh, yes, you can go in the prison, and we signed on to enter the prison again. Only meanwhile, they had set up their cameras and tape recordings so that every conversation that I had with Sheikh Omar by telephone or in the prison were monitored. They heard every word that was said in total derogation of the Sixth Amendment and, of course, the attorney-client privilege, which is part of that.
What appears as if that's not just vanishing in federal prisons, it's vanishing in state prisons as well. Is it not so?
Well, I think so. You know, the states, they are not very slow to follow any leads that Big Brother gives them. So I think that most lawyers nowadays are sort of looking over their shoulders and thinking to themselves, who may be listening in? And if that doesn't create a chilling effect, as you well know, between the communication between attorney and client, we all assumed they might be listening, but not that they might use these things as a basis for further prosecution.
I would hope that you have heard from a number of your colleagues who are in stark protest against this latest governmental action.
The New York Times wrote a piece in their magazine called Left Behind. I think more to encourage people to leave me behind than to, but of course they've been saying the left has been dead in this country for many years, but to the contrary, we're alive and well, and I have gotten outstanding support, not only from the so-called radical or leftist lawyers of the National Lawyers Guild and other organizations, but from the everyday mainstream lawyers who understand that if we can't do this work, even within this racist criminal justice system, the way we have always done it, there will be no right to defend anymore. That right will just vanish. So I have gotten marvelous support. I once said that you have to die to find out how many people love you, but I'm getting it in this life.
Well, that's very good to know. I think that it should obviously, I think, be said that this is not kind of a lawyer's right. This is a right of the accused.
Absolutely. I
so
once
it
said to a...
affects thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, and perhaps millions.
I said to a young documentary maker, you know, it's really not about whether or not this can happen to you, but it really is about if it does happen to you, who are you going to call? Because there won't be a lawyer to call. The whole movement aspect of lawyering will disappear completely as they just knock us off one by one. And to me, that is the real essence of this work, is that we be permitted to lawyer in the way that we lawyered throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and defend people such as yourself in these cases as political people, not just as defendant number 10872.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Lynn Stewart, it has been my pleasure to talk to you and to have others share our conversation, other than the government, of course. And I support you. And I think what you're doing is quite wonderful.
And I may say, Mumia, I support you wholeheartedly. I'm sitting in front of a beautiful banner with African cloth saying Free Mumia and All Political Prisoners. And it has been my work for 30 years, and it will always be my work.
We're going to have to create a new banner saying Free Lynn Stewart.
Yes, I'm for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the best.
You too, dear. Bye-bye.
Fire, a jailhouse lawyer story. On the morning of September 11, 2016, a man in Pennsylvania's prison at Albion awoke in the grip of excruciating pain. Dennis Solo McKeithen put in a sick call slip, and when a duty nurse appeared at his cell door, he exclaimed, "My God, what happened?" Solo told the nurse that he woke up that way. That way meant the right side of his face was swollen, and his right eye was swollen shut. His face wasn't just swollen, it was discolored, and according to Solo, was pink. That's especially disturbing because Solo is a black man with skin the color of coffee. Solo said the male nurse told him he thought he knew what the problem was, but he wouldn't say, so he called the doctor to diagnose the case. A physician's assistant appeared shortly thereafter, and seeing his condition, had him sent to a medical facility where he was given an IV and treated for shingles, a nervous disorder which causes unbearable pain. Solo said it felt like his face and right eye was on fire. Solo was prescribed an antiviral medication. Days later, concerned about continuous eye and skin pain, Solo put in a slip to see the prison's Dr. Jose Boggio. On September 29, 2016, Solo said the following encounter happened. He, Solo here refers to Dr. Boggio, came to my door. He said, "I'm Dr. Boggio, so I'm trying to tell him what's wrong with me." "Oh," he say, "oh, that's nothing. You need to win the lottery." I said, "Lottery?" I said, "What's wrong with you, man?" He said, I'm from South America. I seen all kinds of stuff." I say, "What do that got to do with me?" Solo, disgusted with such a response, turned off his cell light and walked away from the man. Dr. Boggio responded by ordering no more treatment for Dennis McKeithen. In January 2017, Solo, a jailhouse lawyer, filed a motion for a preliminary injunction in the Erie County Court of Common Pleas. On January 17, 2017, a preliminary injunction hearing was held where Solo testified and also conducted examination of several Albion prison and medical staff. The judge, John Garhart, conducted the hearing and announced he believed that medical diagnosis and treatment standing outside a locked prison cell door couldn't be considered a real examination. At hearing's end, he issued an injunction and ordered Solo to be treated by two outside doctors outside of the prison. One had to be an internist to examine his shingles. Solo, jailhouse lawyer, had won. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Rectify the damage to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility 6 years after the disastrous meltdowns. What have been the medical impacts of the radioactive fallout that continues to be leached into the atmosphere and ocean? What would guide Japanese authorities to understate and even lie about the risks posed by the ongoing health impact? What role does Canada have in enabling the nuclear arms race? What does the rise of Donald Trump to the Oval Office and a newly inflamed Cold War mean in the midst of a still nuclear-armed Russia and America? This week, physician, author, and renowned anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott shares her thoughts with the Global Research NewsHour about the nuclear industry and its impacts 6 years after the greatest nuclear disaster of all time. On this week's program, Fukushima, Trump, and the prospects for humanity. A conversation with Helen Caldicott. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 10th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Reporting the situation in Mosul, the Western media prefer not to cover the problems of the local population, who are forced to flee the war, and keep silent about the deaths of civilians from the hands of terrorists. When the city of Aleppo was liberated in the end of last year, the situation was completely different. Although the local citizens were leaving their homes via humanitarian corridors organized by the Syrian military, the media dubbed the situation as a humanitarian catastrophe and blamed the Syrian president Bashar Assad. Hence, a question arises. What hindered the Iraqi authorities and the international coalition from organizing humanitarian pauses for withdrawal of civilians from the besieged city, similarly to what the Syrian government had done? It seems that the Western countries remain indifferent to the destiny of the civilians of Mosul, who have to hide in basements, hoping that they won't be found by terrorists or be mistakenly bombed by the U.S. jets. That comes from the article, Civilians in Iraq Die by Mistake as a Result of U.S. Air Raids, Humanitarian Catastrophe in Mosul, by Firas Samouri, posted March 9th. Turkey and its people have the resources, creativity, and institutions to make Turkey a significant power. Erdogan, who demonstrated an uncanny ability to harness his country's natural and human resources, could have made Turkey such a power on the global stage. Indeed, he would have been the Ataturk of the new era had he simply continued with his historic reforms while protecting the rights of every individual and creating a real model of Islamic democracy. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire was largely precipitated, among other things, by its internal political decadence, the arbitrary exercising of power, and gross violations of human rights that dramatically eroded the foundation on which the empire was built. In whichever form Erdogan wants to resurrect the Ottoman Empire, he will fail, because no country can survive, let alone become great, as long as the government walks on the backs of the people and stifles their freedom to act, speak, and dream. That comes from the article, Erdogan, the Sultan of an Illusionary Ottoman Empire, by Dr. Alon Ben Mir, posted March 9th. For Washington and Ottawa, the Ukraine is a proxy to weaken Russia, which blocked Western plans to topple the Assad regime in Syria. As part of this campaign, 1,000 Canadian military personnel, a naval vessel, and fighter jets will soon be on Russia's border. Where will this lead? A new Cold War against capitalist Russia? or a much hotter war involving direct confrontation between Canadian and Russian troops? That comes from the article, Why is the Trudeau Government Escalating Its Belligerence Towards Russia? By Eve Engler, posted March 9th. The role of Shirley Graham Du Bois and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois in Ghana was indicative of the political character of the CPP government from the period of tactical action, 1951 to 56, to independence, 1957 to 66. Hundreds of African Americans either visited or settled in Ghana during this time period, many of whom making technical and political contributions to the African Revolution, which was centered in Accra. Since the 1960s, the work of the Du Boises has gained attention among many students, intellectuals, and activists in the U.S. and internationally. Nevertheless, the political significance of their contributions remains highly obscured due to the continuing institutionally racist and anti-communist social atmosphere which prevails in colleges and universities in America. The current generation of activists and intellectuals must unearth and review these monumental achievements in order to gain clearer insight into the actual political, social, and economic history of the U.S. That comes from the article, Anti-Imperialism, Pan-Africanism, and Nkrumah's Ghana, The Historic Role of Shirley Graham Du Bois, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted March 9th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Dr. Helen Caldicott is the founding president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a legendary crusader against the nuclear power and weapons industries. She was named one of Smithsonian Institute's most influential women of the 20th century. She's president of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, which informs the public of the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear war. She's authored or edited several books, including Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do in 1979, If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Heal the Earth in 1992, The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex in 2001, and her latest, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. She joins us now from Australia. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Caldicott.
That's a pleasure, Michael.
Okay. I'm wondering if I feel inclined to start with some of the most recent news that's come out. Just in the last month, there was a discovery of the highest ever radiation levels registered, 530 sieverts from the core of Unit 2. And there was also a metal grate underneath the main vessel. It had a 2-meter hole in it. I was wondering if you could maybe just enlighten us on what we should draw and what we should not draw from that finding that was reported last month.
Okay, well, it only means that the robot got closer than ever before to the molten nuclear core. If it had got any closer, it would have measured higher readings than that. The readings are so high that if a man stood at that level of radiation near the core, he'd die very quickly, within minutes. Mm. It didn't actually reach the core, so it means there are, you know, it's much higher where the core is, number one. Number two, yes, there's a hole in the grate, and almost certainly the core melted through the concrete floor as well as the metal grate into the earth. That's where we think that molten core of about 100 tons of seethingly hot uranium with all its fission products, etc., is. The robot itself was destroyed at those radiation readings, so it's unlikely they'll ever get another robot nearer to the core. So the readings haven't gone up. All it means is that we've been able to access the core more closely than ever before.
Okay. So it's not a spike. I mean, it's likely it's just been that high all along for the last
correct.
6 years.
Absolutely correct. But it indicates what an extraordinary situation we have, where there are three molten cores that have melted their way through the reactor container vessels almost certainly and into the Earth, and they're being washed over by huge amounts of water all the time consistently, and about 300 to 400 tons of radioactive water has poured into the Pacific Ocean every day since the accident 6 years ago. The fact is that I predict, and from talking to nuclear engineers, reading the literature, that they will never be able to get those cores back, remediate them, or decommission the reactors, and that this will remain in perpetuity, polluting the Pacific Ocean forevermore. Number one. Number two, if there's an earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, Building 2 we know has been damaged and destabilized by the earthquake. The robot saw that. But the other buildings are also damaged. And if there was an earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, one or two of those buildings could collapse onto the molten cores, producing maybe a fire, nuclear fire, I don't know, but certainly spreading huge amounts of radiation into the atmosphere, making maybe parts of Japan or all of it uninhabitable, and producing tremendous danger for the northern hemisphere as the cloud wafts from west to east around the northern hemisphere. Also, there are over 1,000 huge, huge tanks containing extremely radioactive water, which is not the water that's going to the Pacific. It's water that is being poured constantly into those three reactors to keep the cores cool, still. And it's being extracted. It's seawater. It's being extracted, and it's very, very radioactive, and it's being stored in these huge, huge tanks, which are only built to last for about 5 years. And if there's an earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, those tanks, I don't know, all of them, some of them, few of them, could burst and release that water also into the Pacific Ocean. Number three, they're running out of room to put any more tanks as they get more and more radioactive water. And they're now saying, well, maybe the obvious solution is just to pour the water into the Pacific. Number four, they are treating some of this water to remove some of the contaminants like strontium-90 and cesium-137. But there are over 100 radioactive elements. Not all of them are being removed. And also the system doesn't work very well. I don't know if they are really removing many of them. And what do they do with the filters, which are then contaminated, having filtered out these radioactive isotopes? And also they can't filter out tritium, which is extremely toxic, which biomagnifies in the food chain by orders of magnitude at each step. And tritium is extremely radiotoxic and extremely carcinogenic. So we're facing a situation which is intolerable, irreparable, really, I think. And the fifth point to make is that they're continually injecting nitrogen gas into those three reactors because hydrogen is still being formed by the zirconium cladding of the fuel rods reacting with air. And as we know, we had three hydrogen explosions, or maybe four.
That's what caused the structures to weaken, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're diluting the hydrogen with nitrogen continuously to prevent another hydrogen explosion. So, you know, every which way you look at the situation, it's an absolute total disaster.
Hmm. So if they stop pumping in the nitrogen oxide, then it's just you're at risk of another, probably inevitably there will be another hydrogen explosion?
Well, that's what they think.
Uh-huh. Because you're continually deliberately applying water there, but the water isn't just coming from what they're deliberately spraying onto the core to cool it, right?
No, they built the six reactors in front of a mountain range, The reactors are at sea level because they excavated a huge cliff so that they can put the reactors at sea level. But the mountain range is a problem because huge amounts of water wash down continuously from the mountains into the sea. Now, when the reactors were intact, the water flowed underneath the reactors into the sea and it wasn't a problem. But now, because of the damage that's been done and the fact that those three cores are now exposed to the mountainous water that's pouring into the Pacific continuously, that water becomes intensely radioactive as it flows over and mixes with the cores and takes out many of the radioactive elements in the core and flows into the sea. Now, they thought, well, I'll put a wall of ice, and so they injected these refrigerated cores into the earth and tried to freeze the earth to prevent the water from flowing under the reactor cores and bypassing the reactors. But, of course, it didn't work, number one. And number two, you'd have to have a continuous supply of electricity for the rest of time to maintain the wall or it would melt. And number three, how do you generate electricity? By coal, increasing global warming, by natural gas, increasing global warming, or by nuclear power? And most of the reactors are closed down now anyway in Japan. Now, there is a nuclear engineer who's had another idea, and that is to build a very substantial wall of rock, cement, you name it, instead of the refrigeration wall. And so the water pours down from the mountains and then is bypasses the reactors on both sides. It's diverted into pipes that flow into the Pacific. That has not been done. The Japanese are very proud, and they, until recently, didn't ask for any international help from some of the, you know, the best brains in the world dealing with this situation, and they're now reaching out to ask for some help. I don't know if that wall would solve anything, but it's one solution that has been suggested that might possibly help the situation.
Hmm. What about going back to the reactors? There's also the spent fuel pools. That's the repositories where all of the expired fuel is put, and it's all also on a high, like above the well above the ground. It's in these special reactors, and it's still quite radioactive, but they don't have that coolant. They're not able to keep them cool. And so I'm wondering.
Well, that's a good point, Michael. And I don't remember exactly how many spent fuel assemblies are in each pool. The pool is about 10 stories above ground level, high on the roof of those damaged reactors. Number four, all the rods were removed from that fuel pool. So that has no rods and it has no radiation in the core. That's all been taken out. But one, two, and three still have enormous amounts of highly radioactive spent fuel in their pools. And so, of course, they would collapse too if there were another earthquake which caused the building to collapse. Yes, they could burn if exposed to air. Yes, they have to be continually cooled with water. And, you know, they need 4,000 to 6,000 bodies per day, every day, to maintain an element of safety and piping and all sorts of things. And they're running out of warm bodies. The Yakuza, who is the Japanese mafia, has always been associated with the nuclear industry in Japan, apparently, and they're recruiting homeless people from the streets in Tokyo, etc., mentally deranged people, alcoholics, addicts, you name it, to get more humans there to work the system. Well, the other thing is that those people who go there, many of them are getting really high doses of radiation, and then, of course, they have to be dismissed. I don't think they're looked after. Some have already developed cancers and also leukemia as a result of the radiation, but that's going to happen more and more and more. And you know that they're going to run out of people to maintain any sort of normality, if one can use that word, at that very, very dangerous reactor plant.
That's a bit. I don't think too many people are aware of that. That the Japanese mafia is pulling people off the streets, like homeless people, drug addicted, and so on. What are those people doing on this site? I mean, you would think they probably wouldn't.
Well, they put them up and they put them in their radiation protected suits, which don't protect them. The only thing that can stop gamma radiation and neutron radiation entering the body is lead. And in fact, lead doesn't stop neutrons. And there are focuses or neutrons at certain areas in that reactor complex. But they're not being, I mean, their suits are made of paper and plastic. The radiation just goes straight through them. They look okay, but they're not. They've got respirators, some of them, although it gets too hot sometimes to wear the respirators because there is radiation in the air to be inhaled. The other important thing to note is that the medical profession has allied with the International Atomic Energy Agency in Fukushima, and at the Fukushima Hospital they've built a new cancer hospital, which really tells you everything. They are only looking for thyroid cancer. Now, when Chernobyl occurred, thyroid cancer started appearing 2 years after the accident, and they're still occurring now. Leukemia tends to start occurring, which is cancer of the white blood cells, 5 to 10 years after being exposed to radiation. And solid cancers don't start appearing generally until 15 years later. And their incubation time is anything from, 2 to 80 years. And you don't know when the cancer develops, whether it was caused by radiation or not. The only way to determine that is to take the exposed population epidemiologically and measure the numbers of cancers and compare them to a non-exposed population. However, they've already been looking at thyroids of children who were under the age of 18 at the time of the accident, and they've found about 172 or maybe it's 183 thyroid cancers in these children. They haven't looked at all of them yet. Some of these cancers have metastasized to lymph glands, the lung, etc. The normal incidence in that population of children under the age of 18 is 1 or 2 per million. So we're seeing a huge spike in thyroid cancer, which is an indicator that we will soon be seeing a huge spike in leukemia and other cancers. Remember that children are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive than adults. Little girls twice as sensitive as little boys. Fetuses thousands of times more so. Women are twice as sensitive as men for some reason that we don't understand. But it indicates that it's the tip of the iceberg and that we will be seeing many, many more cancers over time. However, the Japanese medical system such as it is not looking at any other cancers. And the doctors have been told not to tell their patients that their symptoms, whether it's nose bleeding or loss of hair or whatever, could be related to radiation. And if they do, the government stops paying them. The Prime Minister Abe has passed a law to say that any reporters that report honestly on the situation could be jailed for 10 years. So there's a huge, huge, massive cover-up. And they call it the nuclear village in Japan. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and Toshiba really are one and the same with the Japanese government. So the government is passing laws to protect the nuclear industry, not to protect the people. And this is an absolute medical catastrophe, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a number of different agents by which radiation is coming in touch with the people. I guess one would be through the air, the atmosphere, what's been vented out of the facilities, what's going through into the water, and also presumably through the things that people ingest. What would be the primary agent for people living?
Well, there are many ways radiation can enter the body. First, when the meltdown occurred, meltdowns, the very, very short-lived isotopes that only last seconds are very high gamma radiation emitters. Gamma radiation is like X-rays. It goes straight through your body. You don't become radioactive when you've been exposed to gamma radiation, like you don't become radioactive when you're exposed to X-rays. But in the instant that you are exposed, regulatory genes can be mutated in cells, and later the cell might divide uncontrollably, and that's a cancer. Fukushima Prefecture is a very fertile area, and it grows wonderful food, peaches and plums and rice and all sorts of stuff, and milk and cattle farms and the like. Most of the Fukushima Prefecture is quite highly contaminated, especially the dams and the rivers and the creeks, because the water flies down from the mountains and brings with it radioactive contaminants which get into the water. The rice is contaminated, much of it, and so they're diluting it with uncontaminated rice. The solution to pollution by dilution when it comes to radiation is fallacious, because the radioactive elements reconcentrate back in the body. They're looking mostly only at cesium-137 and 134. Cesium is a potassium analog, and it resembles potassium in the body. The body thinks it's potassium. Potassium is highly concentrated in all cells of the body, but particularly cesium tends to go to the endocrine glands, thyroid, pancreas, adrenals and the like, and to cardiac muscle. And we've noted that in the Chernobyl survivors, quite a lot of people are having sudden heart attacks, including children, because of the radiation in the cardiac muscle. Cesium-137, its half-life is 28 years. I think that's right. Cesium-134, which is more radioactive, its half-life is about 2.5 years. You multiply a half-life by 10 to get its total radiological life. So cesium can cause brain tumours and cancers of the endocrine glands, including thyroid, heart attacks, and ovarian cancer and the like. Then there's strontium-90, which is a calcium analog. Its half-life is 28 years. Cesium-137, is about 30 years. So strontium-90 concentrates in bone, where it can irradiate cells to induce leukemia, cancer of the white blood cells that are made in the bone marrow, and also bone cancer. And it concentrates in milk, of course, and cesium concentrates, you know, hundreds of times at each step of the food chain, for instance, in the sea, in the algae, then in the crustaceans, then the little fish, then the big fish, then us. And we stand at the apex of the food chain, and these elements concentrate most highly in us.
Yeah, you're talking about biomagnification, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
That's whole, yeah, of course, people may be familiar with it, with the whole DDT issue.
What I would say to people is do not go to Japan. Do not, under any circumstances, take your children to Japan, because you don't know what you're eating and where the food is sourced. And do not buy Japanese food. Don't buy miso, fish, rice, you name it. Do not buy and eat Japanese food, because you don't know where it's coming from. And the Japanese are trying now to export their radioactive food to London and elsewhere. Taiwan has refused to receive it. But it's dangerous, and it's going to continue to be dangerous for the rest of time. It's sad.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. You said about not going to Japan. That's where the Olympics of 2020 are taking place, and apparently the president had made a successful bid to hold the Olympics there, arguing that they had dealt with the Fukushima disaster. Your thoughts about that?
He lied. And they're going to have some of the events near the Fukushima nuclear power plant. And those beautiful young bodies at the peak of their physical prowess are going to be exposed to radiation in the air because the reactors are still emitting radiation into the air. They're going to be exposed to radiation in the food. And also on the ground level, there are areas in Tokyo where if you collect the soil from the road or the moss on the roof or the vacuum cleaner dust, these bits of dirt, etc., their radiation readings are so high that they would be subjected to being put into a radioactive waste dump in America. That's how high they are. And 35 million people live in Tokyo, many of them being exposed to radiation as they inhale or in their food or as they walk around. I mean, the thing is disastrous. And the Japanese people, I've been there twice, they're desperate to know, desperate. And even if you tell them the truth, which is very scary, they're so grateful because they want to know the truth.
Yes, and could you comment on, because as I understand it, the Japanese government is no longer subsidizing the evacuees who left. So yeah. That puts them in a very difficult situation. You either, you know, come back and face these hazards that you see, and apparently the government doesn't, or they sink or swim on their own for wherever they are.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's what's happening. They're removing the money for them to live outside the contaminated area. I mean, it's really evil what is happening, really evil.
Well, I was just going to ask, what are the incentives for the government to, I guess, is it willful blindness? Is this just we don't care how many people are going to die? Or what would be
the
incentive?
Sweeping the problem under the carpet, so to speak. They don't care, obviously, how many people are going to die. They don't even want to know about it, and they're pretending everything's normal so that they can get the nuclear industry up and running again. That's what it's about. And Japan is a very big player in the nuclear industry. Toshiba and other, Mitsubishi and other huge corporations, make parts for nuclear reactors and export them all over the world, to Saudi Arabia and to all sorts of places, including the containment vessel of reactors. And so they want to keep their export industry going. It's just to prop up the money. And the men, I don't think the men really care whether people live or die. Mm. It's a funny autocratic society where, you know, people who are at the top maintain the power. It's an interesting society. But, you know, America's just as bad. And Canada, you live in a place where you export uranium all over the world. So do we in Australia. Your CANDU reactors make very, very pure plutonium. They are huge emitters of tritium into the air and water. Surveys have shown that children under the age of 5 who live within 5 kilometres of a reactor have double the incidence of leukemia, probably from tritium and carbon-14 that's extruded from the reactors, and they have a high incidence of solid cancers. You are really guilty that your uranium fueled the first nuclear weapons in the world, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You've exported your reactors all over the world so people can make nuclear weapons from them, including India and Pakistan and the like. You are guilty as hell. And Cameco in Canada should be hung, dried and quartered. I mean, you need to close your industry down. And also the uranium is mined in places where there are indigenous people, so it contaminates their food, their livestock, their lives. They die of cancer and leukemia. And there's very little publicity about what's going on in the nuclear industry in Canada.
Yeah, or in the world, for that matter, it seems to me.
Well, yeah, but I'm focusing now on Canada.
Fair enough.
And your new Prime Minister should be doing something about it. I actually met with Pierre Trudeau for an hour and a quarter over lunch in his Prime Ministerial residence. And after that conversation, he led the campaign for a 5-continent, 6-nation peace initiative. He was wonderful. And his son, I'm sure, could walk in his father's footsteps in the nuclear area.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it does seem as if the Liberal government of Justin Trudeau is quite friendly or seeking to be quite friendly with the nuclear industry. And so, I mean,
It does. Well, therefore, you need to get onto his back. He's got young children who he loves. I got to Pierre Trudeau through his children, who he absolutely adored. I won't go into the whole interview, but if you read my book, A Desperate Passion, I describe the whole interview there with Trudeau. And also my film, If You Love This Planet, you know, was made by the Canadian Film Board and won an Oscar for the best documentary.
Yes, so National Film Board.
Played a big role in this, yes.
For sure. I wanted you to comment on the responsibleness of, I mean, you've got the nuclear regulatory authorities, both within Japan and internationally, as well as the World Health Association, you know, the International Atomic Energy Agency. You know, given the urgency that you and Arnie Gunderson and others have been putting out there to try to get this message out, how would you evaluate the way they have responded to this clear and present danger in their actions?
Well, the nuclear regulators are only about one thing, and that's to keep the industry going. They're businessmen. They don't really care about health, and they obfuscate and cover up investigations and don't investigate. You know, the nuclear industry is a carcinogenic industry. They're cancer factories, those nuclear power plants. And if there's a war and a missile hits a nuclear power plant, it could contaminate. Oh, no, if a 1 megaton bomb hits a nuclear power plant, it could contaminate an area the size of West Germany, I think, or Pennsylvania. I can't remember which one. But, you know, you can't have a war in country where there are nuclear reactors, although there are 15 in the Ukraine, including Chernobyl. And there's a war going on there. So that's very, very dangerous.
Mm.
The International Atomic Energy Agency in 1958, got the WHO, World Health Organization, to sign an agreement that WHO would not investigate any nuclear accident from a health perspective unless it got permission from the IAEA. So they're hung, drawn, and quartered. They're totally compromised. They've sold their soul, WHO, to, like Faust, to the devil. So, you know, we work so hard to try and save patients with cancer. My specialty is cystic fibrosis, the most common fatal genetic disease of childhood. There are over 2,600 such diseases. And what the nuclear waste will do is contaminate food chains, water supplies, human bodies, fetuses for the rest of time. And what we're doing is producing a derogatory effect upon the positive process of evolution, let alone inducing epidemics of cancer, leukemia, genetic disease, and deformed babies for the rest of time. Not forgetting that we are not the only ones with genes. All plants and animals have genes, and all can be mutated by radiation. It's an evil, wicked, malicious industry that kills people slowly over time.
I think another important point that to inform our listeners about is I think it's called teratogenesis, this idea that,
yes,
you know, future generations are impacted by what happens to, you know, people who are exposed today. Even if they move to some area that's radiation-free, the impacts will multiply over time, right?
Okay, so teratogenesis means damage to the fetus in the first trimester.
Okay.
In the first 3 months of intrauterine life, the fetus develops all its organs, its limbs, and the like. After that, it just grows in size. Now, the placenta lets nothing through, really. It's very protective of the fetus. Viruses, etc., just don't get through. But, for instance, plutonium, which is so toxic that a millionth of a gram can give you lung cancer, it is an iron analog. So the body thinks it's iron. So it combines plutonium with transferrin, which is the iron transporting protein of the body, and plutonium actually crosses the placenta, and it behaves like the drug thalidomide. It will kill a cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the eye or the right arm. And that's what happened when pregnant women took thalidomide to prevent morning sickness. Their babies were born without arms or legs or the like. It was dreadful. Now, there are hundreds of homes near Chernobyl full of the most damaged, deformed children. And we have never seen this in the history of pediatrics, and I'm a pediatrician. It's really dreadful. If you go to the New York Academy of Sciences, you can get a book from them called Chernobyl, where there are photographs of these very, very deformed children. And so, therefore, pregnant women who are exposed to radiation in the first trimester are likely to have deformed babies. It's kind of like the Zika virus, only that damages the brain. That's a dreadful thing too. That's a teratogenic virus. Now, the other thing to note is, of course, mutations in the eggs and sperm in the gonads. And so every person carries several hundred genes for disease. For instance, I'm a carrier for hemochromatosis, which is a recessive gene, and my ex-husband has it too, and so our eldest son, Philip, has hemochromatosis. It's rare. It only gets expressed if there are two genes together, like you can't have blue eyes unless you have two blue-eyed genes. If you have a brown-eyed gene and a blue-eyed gene, you're going to have brown eyes. Now, we all carry several hundred genes for disease, and that's because the genes in the eggs and sperm have been mutated over time, and we carry these genes for disease, and you don't know you carry them unless you mate with someone with the same abnormal gene. Well, increasing radiation in the environment for the rest of time is going to increase the number and incidence of these very, very bad genetic diseases in both plants, animals, and humans. So we're degrading the positive process of evolution.
Maybe you could address, first of all, the connections between the civilian applications of the nuclear industry and the military applications of the industry, because I think maybe some, like going back to Canada, we maybe because we don't have nuclear weapons and we do contribute extensively with the you know export of uranium, as you mentioned. Can you make a strict division between the civilian industry and the military industry? Like, I'm okay with, you know, civilian applications of nuclear, but we're not going to support nuclear. I mean, does that figure into the this drive for and power of the industry?
No, it's the one and the same industry. There was a psychologist in the Pentagon in 1956 who suggested that America should get into the peaceful atom, so-called, which would then help to avert the allergic response that Americans had to nuclear weapons. And that's really how it started. But you make nuclear weapons by putting uranium in reactors and generating plutonium. You need 5 kilos to make yourself a bomb. Each reactor makes 250 kilos of it a year. Its half-life is 24,400 years. It lasts virtually for the rest of time. A millionth of a gram is carcinogenic. So you supplied uranium for the whole of the American nuclear weapons program at Port Hope, and I've been there. Port Hope is built on uranium tailings and radioactive waste. It's revolting. They've got a huge plant at Cameco, which turns uranium into uranium hexafluoride, which is then sent down as a gas to America to be enriched to 3% uranium-235 to be put in reactors. So you're an integral part of the whole process for bombs and nuclear power. So nuclear power plants are bomb factories and cancer factories. There's no difference, no discrimination. And now they're going to spend in America over $1 trillion in the next 30 years replacing every single nuclear weapon, missile, ship, airplane, aircraft carrier, you name it. Modernizing, they call it. I mean, I'm really pessimistic now that we're going to survive.
Mm. You've said that you might consider evacuating your family from Boston, depending.
Well, yeah, if there's another accident at Fukushima and it's really bad and the Northern Hemisphere becomes heavily contaminated, I'm going to get them out of Boston and bring them down to Australia. Mm-hmm. But if it's a nuclear war, we're all going to die anyway. And I'm sitting here looking at my beautiful garden full of flowers. And that's going to go. And with the madman in the White House who loves generals and has appointed generals to all his top positions in his administration, you know, I really, and he's the only one in America who can press the button. And he has a 3-minute decision time. He's impulsive, narcissistic, lies, cheats. Who knows if we're going to make it? Michael, it's very grim at the moment. It's worse than when Reagan was in office.
Yeah. Well, speaking about what's worse than when Reagan was in office, I mean, maybe your memories are different, but I'm hearing a lot of antagonism toward Russia these days. And I mean, there was antagonism in the 80s, but it seems like it's even higher today. Does this seem like we're back in that Cold War era and that, you know, we were increasing that?
Yes. Well, what's happened is that I think the Democrats' terrible loss in the election, they're trying to blame the Russians so that they don't realize that they should have put Bernie Sanders in instead of Hillary Clinton. He would have beaten Donald Trump. So there's a huge push by the New York Times, Washington Post, and major media in America to indemnify Russia, not indemnify, but to make Russia look wicked. Now, the situation in the Ukraine is such that the State Department, with Victoria Nuland and Robert Kagan and the neocons, orchestrated the coup in the Ukraine. The Russian, about 40% of the people in the Ukraine are Russian-speaking, and they're in the East. And they didn't want America put a real Nazi in as the head, Poroshenko, who's also corrupt. And he wants everyone to speak Ukrainian, and the people in the East who were very closely allied with Russia didn't want to join this whole thing, and he's, you know, cutting out their pensions and healthcare and stuff. So Putin sent some troops in to support those Russians, number one. Number two, the Crimea. They had a referendum in the Crimea, and 96% of the Crimeans voted to stay under the Russian orbit. And number three, they have enlarged NATO, which is really America, right up to the borders of Russia. It's like the Warsaw Pact has come in and is right along the border of Mexico with America. I mean, America would go Burko and probably blow up the world like it nearly did with the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that it's an artifice constructed by the military-industrial complex in America who want to keep Russia as a Cold War enemy, and by the deep state, the politicians and the CIA and the FBI and all the rest. But if you listen to Putin's speeches, and he has long, long press conferences, they're very balanced. Mm-hmm. They're very sane. And he's saying, well, we want to be friends with you. Let's be friends. And also they want to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And on that note, there is a very important thing happening in the United Nations this year where 123 nations have come together in an effort to outlaw nuclear weapons, like we've outlawed landmines and chemical weapons and the like. The countries that are avoiding it and are averse to it, of course, are America, Russia, because if America doesn't do the right thing, Russia won't, and, of course, all the other nuclear nations. So we're between a rock and a hard place, and I'm not sure about Canada. I don't know if you support that resolution or not, but it's imperative that Canada does.
We've got, looking at Trump's cabinet, you know, you've got Mike Pence as vice president. You've got the energy secretary, Governor Rick Perry, Rick Tillerson, who's an ex-Enron, and all the generals that you mentioned, including someone named Mad Dog Mattis. So, if they say structure is strategy in slow motion, but how do things look going forward?
Very grim. I mean, if Trump gets impeached, we're going to have Pence, who is he looks more sane than Trump, but he's revoltingly right-wing and very dangerous. Mm. Tillerson, he orchestrated all the Exxon stuff, and I think he owns lots of oil and Russia and stuff. At least he's friendly with Russia, and that's important. But I don't know how much power he has. Bannon, who's really mad, loves war, has been a historian on war for nearly all his life, and he's probably tickled pink that many of the people in the administration are generals who like war. Mad Dog Mattis, I think he's the one who'd like to blow up Iran. I'm not sure, but that's just crazy stuff. Iran has no nuclear weapons. That's just running Israel's line. We're in the hands of really, really, really dangerous people. And as Bannon said quite openly the other day, that they've appointed people in all the departments, EPA and health and you name it, who want to dismantle State Department. They want to dismantle all the departments and all the laws that people have worked so hard to produce over hundreds of years in America. It's like the worst nightmare you can imagine, and every day I think, well, I'll wake up and it won't really be happening, but every day it gets worse.
I anticipate that what's happening here with Trump and at large, I mean, with Japan, TEPCO and all that, the specter of being able to make a profit and hold on to your profits is overcoming the rational decisions to keep, to put off a danger. It's like people are just inattentive to the these hazards that are out there. Maybe they're just crossing their fingers and hoping nothing will happen. There's just too much money to be made to be concerned about the health of our children, apparently.
The survival of our children. I've got a book coming out in July called Sleepwalking to Armageddon. It is the proceedings of a symposium I had 2 years ago at the New York Academy of Medicine about the imminent threat of nuclear war. And, you know, I've got Chomsky and all sorts of really wonderful people who've written articles. It's published by the New Press, and I'd advise you to get that if you possibly can. Sleepwalking to Armageddon, July.
Okay.
And with that, Michael, I think I probably need to end.
Okay. Can I just ask you one more question before we go?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We're having this conversation on International Women's Day, and I guess I was wondering if there's if somehow the consciousness of International Women's Day can be used to somehow work on this imperative of mitigating this clear nuclear threat.
It's an excellent question, Michael. I'm writing a book called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them. 52% of the world's population are women. The way they're treated by the Muslims, having to cover up everything, is obscene. The Catholic Church, the way they treat women, is obscene. I thought I'd become a Buddhist, but they're very patriarchal too. It's time women took over. Men have made a terrible, terrible mess of things. And we've got the hormones oxytocin and estrogen and progesterone, which are nurturing hormones. We need to step into our power and stop being wimps and saying, look, you blokes, you've had your time, you've mucked up, we're on the brink of extinction and we're taking over now. And that takes after the myth in Greek mythology, Lysistrata, where the men kept fighting and killing and fighting and killing. Finally, the women said, okay, no more sex. And they stopped. And that happened in Liberia too, I think, recently, where the women said, okay, no more sex. And the men, why do men need sex so badly, number one? And number two, probably when they stop fighting and killing, they get their sex back and they'll start fighting and killing again. I really, it's a conundrum, Michael, but it's time we rose to our full moral and spiritual power and said, okay, you know, you all need your bottom smacked. You're about to destroy life on the planet. We're taking over.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much. You've been very generous with your time today, and I wish you all the best in your ongoing lobbying and activist efforts.
Thank you, Michael, and the same to you.
Okay, thanks so much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate Helen Caldicott. She's the author of several books on the nuclear danger, including the upcoming Sleepwalking to Armageddon. You can get more details of her work by visiting the site helencaldicott.com.
I study nuclear science. I love my classes. I got a crazy teacher. He wears dark glasses. Things are going great, and they're only getting better. I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright.
You're listening to the song, The Future's So Bright, I Gotta Wear Shades, from the band Timbuk3 from their 1986 album, Greetings from Timbuk3. And with this song, we conclude this week's installment of the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show can also be downloaded from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Please join us again next week for more on the Fukushima disaster and the dark side of the nuclear industry. Bye for now.